Hey there. Welcome to the SmackDown, the New Economy SmackDown. My name is, can you guys hear everything okay so far, so good?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Jennifer Wright Cook. I'm executive director of The Field, and this is my partner in crime.
Robert Elms, the director of Galapagos.
And Robert and I have been talking for months now about wanting to do an event that was about the economy and how messy it is and how challenging it is. And so we were finally able to get this date together to do what we're calling the New Economy SmackDown. I want to give you a brief etymology of the word SmackDown. That was the SmackDown, but tonight is actually, it's a bit of a misnomer because it's not about beating each other up or taking a competitor down. It's actually about finding answers, finding solutions, about coming together as a community to find ways that we can do it better in the future. So, but I just love the word SmackDown, and actually our office staff has been saying SmackDown about everything these days, so feel free to appropriate that terminology for your own life if that works for you. With that in mind, there are some ground rules about tonight. Tonight is not a bitch session. Excuse my French. It is, it's not about saying we need more money, because we all need more money. And there are a lot of people who need more money who are not artists. So we're going to try and keep the parameters really positive and really open and really solution-driven and really active. So if you can keep to those guidelines, that would be fantastic. Robert has something to say now as well.
Well, thank you all very much for coming. I just wanted to make you aware of a couple of programs that we have at Galapagos. We have a new theater funding model that we're really proud of, and it basically gives people the opportunity. It's social networking meets its venture philanthropy, And the idea is that for $100, you can invest in theater, and for that $100, you get a stake in the production. So if we find the next Chorus Line, in theory, you could somewhere make money. Then you own, along with us, part ownership in a racehorse out at Belmont, and we all go out and watch the horse run. So that's the social networking part. And then the other component to that is you can go skydiving with us at cost. We can't afford to pay for that, but we can do this. We have a resident artist program here at Galapagos that we've sent two artists to Switzerland for 6 months. They're currently there. And the other side of that is if you're an artist in residence in Galapagos, our intention is to pay your rent within a year to give you enough work through the venue that you are able to pay your rent. And our job is to double your audience inside of a year as well. So this is our contribution. And we think that it's time really for a new model in culture. And this funding crisis has exposed the need for a model because the one that we have is so fundamentally flawed that we're stuck in this mess. And we think it's unethical and bordering on corruption that a system is so fragile that with every cyclical recession, the poor participants who are invited to participate in culture and to work in culture are cut. Staffs are cut, et cetera. And the system is without stability, frankly. And we will never attract the best and brightest to culture, which is where they belong, with a system similar to this. So we really want to try to find new models in our taking everyone out to watch the horses race is sort of an enthusiastic response to the cultural funding crisis. But anyway, thank you all very much for coming. I'm going to be sort of co-moderating. It's the first time I've ever co-moderated, so I'm a little nervous. But thank you all very much for coming, and this is Jennifer.
Good job so far. I'm a little bit of a control freak, so I wanted to give you guys an opportunity to understand the arc of tonight so you can have some control yourselves. We're going to do, after this little spiel, we're going to do a fireside chat with Heather Hitchens, who's the executive director of NISCA. After that, we're going to have our first panel, which we've been calling Cultural Gatekeepers and Stakeholders. Then a surprise will happen, and the surprise will happen around 8:10. And that'll give you time to so be prepared for the surprise. And then after that, we're going to do panel number two, which is the Cultural Entrepreneur Panel. There's going to be plenty of opportunity for question and answer from all you guys. This is not a we know and you don't know opportunity. This is we all know, but some people are up here because why? Because, in part, Claudia LaRocca at WNYC started a blog, and you should all check it out. And she asked our dear friend Morgan Pacelli, who's one of the panelists, to do a little soapbox manifesto about the state of the arts. And Morgan wrote this incredibly astute and articulate manifesto, which you should read. And then it started this dialogue amongst a lot of people in the community that was very passionate and very action-oriented and just and super comprehensive, covering so many bases, history of different recessions and history of arts and presenters and gatekeepers. And so I talked to Morgan. I said, let's get that live on stage. So I owe a huge debt of gratitude to Claudia, who will be here later tonight, and to Morgan, but also to all the people who contributed to that blog. She's right over there, right down there. Yay, Claudia, thank you very much. So this dialogue tonight will also hopefully be continued on that blog, as well as, you know, the Fields blog, other blogs. There's Twitter opportunities as well. I'm supposed to give a shout out to Twitter. Stolen Chair TC, is that correct, is Twittering. And I guess the Field is Twittering, and maybe you are Twittering too, whatever that really means. What else? We are also podcast. We're going to audio record tonight, so watch your mouth, I suppose, and curse words, because it will be on the website. And cell phones off. Cash bar, drink alcohol or whatever you drink. Proceeds go to Galapagos. And restrooms around the back. And that is it. Is there anything else you want to say?
That's all. And we're ready to begin.
Great. I'd love to introduce Heather Hitchens to the stage at this point.
Growing up, fireside chat, mantle chat meant I was in trouble, and you know, so I'm going to try and not have a flashback.
Well, this is definitely not a Niska is in trouble moment, and I don't want that to be the tone of this at all. I actually had the opportunity about 2 months ago to sit with Heather, and Sasha Soref and Audra Lang at the Field, and have a really incredible 2-hour conversation about the arts. And Heather kept saying, we are in the cone of silence. And I really felt that. And I so appreciated your ability to step into that conversation, to just talk about what we're doing. And for the Field as a service organization to have that conversation with NISCA, a government agency, was really impactful to me. So I hope we can share some of that inspiration and effort tonight as well.
Sure.
So I'm going to toss a few questions at Heather. One, obviously, economic smackdown, the economy smackdown. We all know that the old economy was broken mm-hmm. in a lot of different ways, and now we're looking for new ways to have a sustainable life in the arts. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, this has been certainly an incredibly difficult time for the arts community, certainly NISCA. But one of the things that I'm very clear about is I don't want to underestimate what's happening in the economy, but if we face the facts, we were not rolling in dough before the economic decline. Every issue that we have is just being, you know, it's just more pronounced. The arts field is under-resourced. So that's the first thing about the economy, is that I think it's just emphasis on what was already happening, and that things needed to change, you know, all around. The second thing that has really struck me, and you know, prior to NISCA, I was the president of Meet the Composer for almost a decade, working with composers, and I started my life as an artist, and so I have a deep connection to artists, and you know, I hear the organizations talking about, oh, you know, how hard it is, and it is hard for the organizations, but I'm really struck by the fact that the vast majority of artists, it's not different that the organizations are suffering, because we're not touching the vast majority of artists. None of the structures that have been created, we've done a really good job of building a structure for arts and cultural organizations over time. I don't think we've built the structure to support artists, and I think when we built that structure, we thought that supporting organizations, I say we, the royal we, sort of not blaming anyone in the field in general. Maybe we could blame a few funders, I don't know. But anyways, you know, it was really a structure, and I think people thought that the money would flow through the artists. And what we found over the years is the money trickles down to a few artists. Now, there are fantastic organizations like the Field, but they're tremendously under-resourced. And therefore, at the end of the day, my concern is good economy, bad economy, there's very little of the what you call arts funding such that it is that's making it into the pocket of artists. And so we have to ask ourselves a question, and when you ask about the model, how do we change the model? Because if we're not supporting the artists, what are we really doing?
it's a great point, and Heather brought up the fact from her bio, which I forgot to say, which is that you spent years at Meet the Composer, and so you have both sides of the fence in your brain and probably in your vision of what's possible at NISCA mm-hmm. in terms of working with artists directly, re-granting funds, working with donors, knowing that you have to raise funds for your own organization. How does that impact your work at NISCA and how you see that?
You know, it's interesting because when I was coming towards my decade mark at Meet the Composer, I thought, you know, I really shouldn't stay for more than 10 years as president, but I have no idea what I want to do. And the NISCA opportunity came up, and I was interested in it because I thought, you know, I was so frustrated trying to do what I was trying to do to get money to artists, and I wanted to try my hand at being on the policy side to see if we could change some things that would really make a difference. And so, you know, but it is, you know, there are days that I wake up and say, how did a redheaded drummer from California end up as, you know, a state government employee? But what I bring to it is, you know, I come to NISCA with great respect for the fact that NISCA was the first state arts agency in the country. It's still the largest. And I think that they've done a really good job over the years in terms of getting the money out broadly. That being said, NISCA really defined what public support for the arts was in 1960, and we haven't changed since then. So there's definitely sort of an updating to do. So I had three things that I saw that needed to happen. One was we were pretty much disconnected from government. And what I mean by that is we didn't have relationships with other agencies like economic development, like parks, like education, and that seemed like something that should be fixed because there are resources within those other agencies that can also benefit the arts, and we should have a relationship. So we went about fixing that, and we just finished 10 cross-sector conversations in upstate and Long Island. New York City is coming next, where it was about a third of people from other sectors and two-thirds cultural organizations and artists, and really saying, you know, how do we use the resources we have more effectively, and what other resources are out there within these other sectors that we can sort of wrangle for the arts. So that was one goal, and I think we're really well on our way there. The second goal was to demand of NISCA the same that we demand of our grantees, and doing a serious look at our process and how, you know, what needs to change about the process. Are there things that are antiquated about the process? Yes, 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 yes. And to sort of move forward. And one of the things that concerned me is that the way we were defining the universe of arts and culture in New York State was by who was coming to NISCA. And, you know, we reach a lot of organizations, but I know there's a whole universe of organizations that we don't reach. I also felt strongly that we needed, well, history was important, you know, a history with an organization, that history should never trump merit in a process, and that it was harder. We try to be really helpful to new organizations, but it was harder for new organizations, no matter what level of work they were doing, to get funding, and that we needed to look at that. So this year we've instituted basically all applications are looked at through a meritorious process and a rating system based on our criteria and not based on historically, you know, how organizations had been funded. And, you know, our hope is that there can be some more equity in the spreading of our dollars as a result of that.
With that in mind, I feel like, at least from my experience at the field, in the past 2 to 3 years, the shifts at DCA and at NISCA have been significant in transparency, but also in openness in terms of their processes mm-hmm. and new artists coming in all the time. And mm-hmm. we fiscally sponsor, you know, 400 artists, and I feel like that roster has grown, mm-hmm. except for the last budget cuts, obviously. But right. I'm really appreciative of that transparency and openness. And I imagine that many of you in the audience probably do not get NISCA funding, or do not get DCA funding. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Miguel. So I think it's also a really wonderful opportunity, you know, for our audience to think about what is NISCA and what does it actually do for me, but also for NISCA to hear from you guys eventually, not quite yet, but eventually about how things are working for you. You said very clearly that the trickle-down doesn't really trickle, and we know that clearly. Most artists, having absolutely nothing to do with merit, are not getting funding from a variety of sources that call themselves emerging funders, not about NISCA, but about, they're saying they're for emerging funders. Do you have any thoughts about that and how New York can possibly sustain all of the worthy artists?
Well, yes, I do have a thought about that. And, you know, one thing that's been very clear to me is that we haven't created a movement in the arts. And I say this because I'm up in Albany when budget cuts are happening, and I see the education community in mass. I see the healthcare, you know, community in mass. And, you know, I go around and visit legislators and say, you know, the economic impact of the arts in New York State is $25 billion. Really, I've never heard that before. You know, it's a two-way street. But I do think, you know, one of the things that makes the arts great is our independence, but we've got to find those points of connection that we can create a movement, because it is in the economy. You know, it kills me, you know, to hear people say, well, you know, arts are expendable, and they're actually not. I actually don't know of any community revitalization that has ever occurred without the arts, and yet we're still in this position. I actually think, and, you know, obviously, you know, NISCA can be a voice and an advocate, but we can't be a lobbyist in the same way that all of you can do it. But I actually think that we're a little bit too polite in our advocacy. And, you know, we're still having arguments about, well, if you talk about economic development, then you're not talking about art. And I don't see the distinction, and here's why. It's not anything other than artists doing what they do that create the economic development. We're not trying to bastardize it. Excuse my language, but, you know, that's on tape. Okay. But, see, I told you, the redheaded drummer now in a government. I'm still adjusting, obviously. But it's not that. It's just about owning it. And one of the things I think, you know, we've been trying very hard at NISCA to get a sense of how big the field is. You know, going to different service organizations, there are all kinds of different numbers, you know, out there about how big the field is, because I think we're undercounted, and by being undercounted, we're not as powerful in terms of an advocacy. So I think, you know, it's we do need to create a movement, you know, and I think people get discouraged by some of the advocacy efforts. But what I want to say is that this year people came together, and there was an increase to the budget of $3.5 million that was added back. Now, you know, you have to put that into context, that in 1989 we were at $54 million, and given that the cultural organizations, the biggest number I can find, we have 5,400 cultural organizations, we don't really have a count on the number of artists, so we say hundreds of thousands. That's my initial thought.
That just made me think about, you know, one of the things that came up in some of the discussions preparing for this was the metrics that we often use with funders, mm-hmm. Particularly with the electeds, as they like to be called, are money driven. So it's this many billions of dollars impact, and this many jobs, and this many tourists in New York. And one of the things that's come up is, for instance, I think it was Aaron Landsman who pointed out Portland, Oregon, saying, you know, yes, that's all true, and those are important numbers, and also, it is a core value. Creativity is a core value of us as a human culture. And in this time of hope with Obama and new things happening, can we include the numbers and also add back in that very important piece?
I think that's essential, because I think the arts we're the only field that can do both, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe there's some others, but not quite as well as we do it. And, you know, and I think this idea that creativity is an essential skill, you know, whether you're going to be an artist or you're just going to be in the world. I mean, I think we've you know, in a different way, and I think we've lost that. We've certainly lost that because, you know, arts education is pretty much, you know, nowhere. I mean, I shouldn't say nowhere. There are a lot of organizations doing really good work, but we do have, in the state of New York, a policy that all kids are supposed to meet art standards. And it's a policy that is not optional, but it's not tracked and it's not mandated. And data says that we have right now that only 4% or 7% of New York City kids are meeting those standards. So, not to turn this into an arts education conversation, because I don't really want to go there, but I just use it as a framework for where creativity is valued right now, which is not very much in the education side of things.
So to do a little takeaway on that, I think we need to know our numbers. We need to be able to, you know, advocate and really lobby on our own behalf and to speak the truth. But also the creativity is a core value. But one of the things I find really challenging, even in this scenario, is we, the field, receive funding from NISCA. So I'm automatically always aware, some part of my back brain of, must be careful, how to be aware of, I need something from you. In theory, you need something from me as well, but it's been so hierarchicalized that it's often very difficult to approach us in any way that's meaningful or truthful, and
certainly having been on the other side of the fence for so long, that was one of my frustrations. Like, why can't we just have a conversation? Now, obviously, you know, and speak the truth, and you know, obviously, I'm in a little bit of a different position because we have a process, you know, that where there's a panel and everything. And yes, I can make policy decisions about shifting that process to make it even more, you know, transparent and all of that. But you know, I am doing this job because I was on the other side and was frustrated, and I want to make it better. And I'm not going to make everyone happy and be able to do everything, but I want to hear what people have to say, because to try and manage in a vacuum and try and, you know, and believe me, any change at a government agency is like, you know, it takes a long time, and that's been an adjustment because, you know, at Meet the Composer, if I want to change something, I just changed it, you know?
Right.
You know, and it's and part of the problem with changing anything is that you want to keep the money flowing to the field while you're changing it. I sort of liken it to changing the car tires as the car is in motion. So, but I think, you know, I think honest, respectful dialogue, you know, that we're all in this together, and that there's a real sort of, that everybody's, you know, good faith is, you know, in this, and it's a good faith effort in terms of the conversation, is really important. And I don't think we have that. And I'm always aware that there's a power dynamic.
Yeah. Speaking of the power dynamic, we were talking before tonight about the recent announcement of the NEA appointment, which, if you don't know, was
Rocco Landerman.
Broadway
Did
producer.
Did I say it right?
Rocco Landsman.
Somebody else has the name Landerman. That's what got in my head. Yes, Landsman.
Broadway producer. Mm-hmm. This seems like quite a curious choice. What are your thoughts about his potential? I don't know if you're allowed to respond to that, or if that's plead the fifth.
Well, I think that it's an interesting choice. I think it's not a usual suspect, and you know, we'll see how I think it could play out. I don't know him, so you know, to comment on him, I can only do it in sort of in theory. It's not a same old moving the funders around the around from one foundation to one government agency to the other. So, I'm always hopeful when there's a change, and I think that it's good to not just lay back. I think we should find out, you know, we should communicate with them, make sure, you know, the cultural community is heard about what they liked about what was going on at the NEA and what they didn't like about what's going on. Like, there's a window of opportunity, and I'd say, you know, let them hear from you.
With that in mind, I just want to sort of close this segment up for a second, for this part of the evening, and wonder if you have any last words of wisdom, best practice advice for this ambitious and hardworking community out there.
Well, it's best practices in this environment is hard to talk about, but I think one of the things, if we could really come together on some of the things that we agree about, because there are a lot of silos, right? We even have them inside of our own agency, but and really, you know, I know we said we're not going to talk about money, but it all comes down to it, that there's not enough of it. And I just think that if we can have a series of conversations about what needs to change and how we can change it and help define our own destiny, I think too often, and it's kind of the way it's set up, we wait to find out what the X Foundation's focus is going to be, and then we run to, you know, to meet that. And what I'm hoping is maybe we can reverse that a little bit so that the arts community can define the arts community. And I think that NISCA is in a position to help with that because we have our process, which is mostly about operating support, and not, we try not to have a very specific agenda. And, you know, one of the things that I would love to do is, you know, and we have begun to do, is have dialogues with other funders in the arts about, because I think we're in some ways, and especially if we do better at reaching more broadly into the arts ecology, we're in the position to be in the catbird seat and really tell them, here's what's going on, because they may lack information in a way that, you know, we can provide helpful information in terms of what's going on and maybe have a conversation about how philanthropy can play a role. You know, I do have moments where I think the whole model should just be blown up, but I haven't come up with what the new model would look like. So,
well, just to tag on that, I think that so much of it is about us having confidence in what we do and just speaking to that, and again, not antagonistically, but just as much as we can from a level playing field of, mm-hmm. I have this great resource of my art, and you have this resource of your money, and you have these goals, and I have these goals. Where do we meet? And instead of running it from a place of scarcity, of the groveling place, mm-hmm. but really coming at a level playing field as much as we can, I think things can shift, but it's got to be, we have to do it. I don't feel necessarily those shifts often coming from the funding community towards us, but us going, like squeezing it and trying to make it happen.
Right. And that is the hardest work, the work that all of you do and that I used to do, is the hardest work of almost anything, and particularly, you know, and thankless. And, you know, you're not compensated well, and yet people continue to do it. And, you know, I have confidence that the arts will endure. They always do endure, but I guess I'm tired of survival, you know, and being grateful for the crumbs. And I don't have the answer, but I would love to sort of put the smart, you know, brains together and figure out how do we get to the point where we're thriving? How do we get to the point where artists are being valued and compensated and creativity is valued as a core value in our society, an essential skill? How do we get to that place?
Well, on that incredibly optimistic note, I'm going to ask you guys to give a warm thank you to Heather. Thank you so much. And panel number one is going to make its way to the stage.
Thank you so much.
Is a thing with your name on it over here. So let's assume. Yeah, so you can stand behind us. Yeah. Are you going to actually read your
rectangle?
No, are you talking about the device, not the content? I'm such a gear whore over there. Who is we?
I don't get the ball rolling.
And we're back. I have to just say that in the little nook over there, after Heather was leaving, she said, is this going to be audio cast? Is it going to be podcast? Is it going to, you know, what happens next? And can we, what can we do next? And we, you know, wanting to have focus groups and wanting something to happen. And I know, and I think Robert and I agree that talking is awesome. And I've been to probably a dozen seminars, panels, conferences in the past 6 months about how things aren't working and what can we do. And they're great discussions. And then we go away and we all feel bad again and we take a bath or whatever we do and have a glass of wine. And and nothing happens, and I'm a big believer in, like, what can happen, what can actually happen. So I'm really pleased that Heather was here and that she took that little side fireside chat and said that about action, because it's not enough to just talk. I mean, that changes your chi, I think, but, like, then you got to do something with it. So in any case, this is panel number one, cultural stakeholders and gatekeepers. Da-da-da! The way we've set this up as a smackdown is I asked, Robert and I asked each of the panelists to prepare a 1 to 2 minute soapbox manifesto. And for a while, we even thought we'd have an actual soapbox that they could stand on and sort of do their little rant. But so we asked each of these rabble-rousers to write a 1 to 2 minute rant. And what I'd like to do is go one by one in a very performative and scary way, and have them deliver their rant in whatever way they want, and then we'll dissect, analyze, talk, get some questions and answers, do it with each one by one. So that'll hopefully generate some dialogue and some questions and some query. So which courageous soul would like to start? Or do I need to pick?
I'll go first. Cause,
go in this order.
Yeah, can we just go down the line?
Yeah, excellent.
I can't say it's going to be a rant. And I just want to say, I'm sure I'm going to cover stuff that's already been brought up, so, you know, apologies, and that will be brought up. So I teach people how to do public speaking for my day job sometimes, and I'm so bad at it that I actually had to type up my whole rant. So here we go. I'm Aaron Lantzman. It used to be that the arts were or seemed to be an exceptional and broken economy. So many people were making so much money out there while we were taking a loss, it must just have been our fault. But now a lot of systems are in disrepair, like education, banking, and healthcare, for instance. So what has changed, and what do we do? Here are two small things. One, we address the scarcity model. And two, we submit the work's real cost and value. So a few months ago, I was at an Art New York fundraising roundtable. When the subject of funding cuts came up, people started saying, we got to learn how to do more with less. I think that every year since 1993, whether the economy was booming or busting or staying just the same, I have heard someone, an artist, development person, funder, or presenter, say that. We got to do more with less. And when I hear that, I can almost hear a kind of relief, like crisis mode keeps us from having to risk real failure or real transcendence. So I want to advocate doing less with more. Make fewer, more brilliant shows, don't put them up until they're ready, and ask for enough to get them done right. And now, for presenters and funders, this can be really tough. You've got all these fabulous artists who want your help. You've got a staff who needs a salary. You've got grantors or legislators or boards asking you to justify everything you do in terms of artistic excellence, community engagement, access, education, and diversity, all for $3,200 a year. And no one raises an eyebrow when you say you're commissioning a piece for $5,000 that really costs 70 grand. But until we address this, then maybe the system's functioning just as it should. People are making a lot of art, labor costs are incredibly low, this is what the market has borne. So, do we want to change the game? And if so, how? I think for starters, and this is the theatrical policy wonk in me, we could make budgets that reflect the real cost of the work, including the amount that we are all subsidizing the field via day jobs, credit cards, trust funds, or partners. I think that freeing up the truth by doing the numbers right ultimately allows us to advocate in a new way. We can stop relying too heavily on a skewed notion of economic impact that's based on all of us doing the work for too cheap, and we can start being citizens with allies in other fields that are also asked to do more with less and who are also driven by a mission. We can start addressing creativity as a core value and the articulated imagination as one of the few things that separates us from other species.
Wow.
I think it is a wonderful idea, the idea that we really have to transcend, you know, sort of what we've been expecting and what we've been declaring as our right in some ways, and I think that's a very valuable point.
I'm also the whole idea of valuing what you do and really looking at all those costs, I think is terrifying for most people. We're so trained to think, I can only ask for that amount. And oftentimes funders will say, can you cut that? Can you cut that? Can you cut that? What do you really think about how to help the artists, how to help artists, and you are one yourself, so I know you deal with this, really have the courage to put on the line item, like, this is what I'm worth. My time, and I'm worth this. What do you...
Well, when I teach workshops, I tell people, figure out what your life costs to live the way you need to live it for a year, not what you can get by on for a year, right? So that includes health insurance. If you have a family, it includes life insurance. It includes vacation, because people don't function well without a little time off, right? And so figure out what that cost is, and that's different for every single person here. You know, I know artists who can do it on $25,000 a year who value an economy of scale, which I think is really wonderful. And I know other artists who feel like it's $150,000 a year because they like to get their nails done every week. I don't know, you know? And those are fine. Like, both of those are fine, right? Miguel's like, I like to get my nails done. So you figure out what that cost is, and then you just, you know, amortize your time. You go, and then you track your time, and you say, all right, I spent 250 hours on this piece, right? It means it's incumbent on us to figure out, you know, to do some sort of like spreadsheet nerdy stuff and figure out, this is how much time it takes, this is how much my life costs, that's what it costs. That's actually what it costs. And then, you know, if you're making a budget, I think you should put your own time, if you're contributing money that you've made from a day job to pay for your time, then you should put that down as an individual contribution. I mean, I think that's, for me, that's legit. And that's what I advise artists to do.
I also want to let Morgan and Brian and Moira know that please pipe up as you like. This is not you guys are silent
please.
Mode. So do you guys want to pipe up on something?
Well, I would just say it's a really interesting and strange discussion to have about how you would attribute cost to things, because costs are real and they just mm-hmm. exist in the world. And whether a funder wants to know that your show cost $75,000 to make, it still costs that
right.
much to make.
That's exactly right.
And I don't know what we stand to lose by alerting them to the fact that we are, in fact, spending this amount of money to make work.
Yeah, I agree. That was my question when you said the fear, you know, about revealing that information. I just, from being in the room in panels, I have certainly never heard a panelist say, Jesus Christ, he's getting, you know, $10,000 to, you know, never. In fact, it's quite the opposite. I mean, you know, the issue would be that if we get 737 budgets, which we got this year, and they all were at their real costs, we now fund 5% of what we receive. We'd be funding less than 1% of what we receive, right? So, I mean, it's on that end of it that it gets complicated.
That's an interesting statement, because I think one of the problems that the artists that I've worked with have is figuring out how to measure and value their labor time, right? So they will come to me with a budget of $15,000 that doesn't actually indicate any of them getting paid, even if it's fake imaginary Monopoly money, getting paid at a rate of like $25 an hour. Right? So that's one aspect of it. But then I've also encountered funders who looked at a project and said, but there are only two performers in here. Why are the human resources, you know, payroll costs so high? And it's like, well, because a show is more than the two people on stage. The show is also all the technical people and all that kind of stuff. So I think there are sort of miscommunications about the value of the human resources, so to speak, as much as there are about the materials that we find but would have sold for street value at, you know, $75, but we found in the garbage for $0, right? But actually, that took us an hour to find it, so there's an hour worth of labor time, which is, you know, closer to $75 than to zero, in theory.
I'll just, you know, one thing, too, for me is that I think there are models that are established models, like NPN pay structure, equity, two models of... Mm-hmm. living wage that to me aren't living wage, you know? And so I think sometimes I've encountered funders who are like, but you're paying more than equity, or presenters that are like, you're paying more than NPN. And with ERS, you know, we go back and say, $700 a week is not middle class in New York City if you're paying your own health insurance. So we do have to have the, I mean, so I think, more, I think that you're ahead of the curve in a way, I mean, and having also been in the room at MAP panels, that the conversation is a little bit more enlightened about what it costs to live in America now. Part of it is helpful to know that these models are a little outdated, because then that, again, is another way you can form an alliance with any other group of people who want to be middle class, who are being told this is what you're supposed to get paid, and it's not covering it. You know, that's about a bunch of different systems being broken. But we do sometimes have to educate people who are doling out money or deciding on what those structures are.
And stand up to it.
Yeah.
I mean, not back down when somebody says to you, yeah, you're getting paid too much. No, this is what I'm worth.
Well, no, that was to get, sort of answered my question, what you said, because I'm very interested in the fear itself.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to get too wazzy-woo, but, I'd love to have that articulated. I mean, I think I could articulate for myself in a different context, but...
Yeah, I think some people go, if I knew what it costs, I would never make the work, because it would cost so much, more than the money that I'm getting in.
So the fear for them to even name it to themselves is that they won't make the work.
Is that will keep you from making the work.
And what about the fear of...
Is that right? I mean...
Oh, I don't know.
Well, it can be really depressing. I mean, I just did this for myself last week, and I make $1.95 an hour. When you add it, I mean, I'm not even exaggerating.
Right.
When you add it all up,
right,
in real terms, it's ludicrous.
Right.
Should we move on to the next manifesto?
And let me say that those of you who are waiting for the surprise at 8:10. It's going to be a little later, so just relax. Morgan von Prell-Pacelli.
Yeah, so last night I wrote out a really big, long manifesto. I have a difficulty with brevity, as some people are very aware. And then this afternoon I emailed Jennifer 6 words and said, this is all I'm going to say, and... I'm going to say more than 6 words, but I will maybe give you the short version and then can, in the discussion, sort of... in response to the 6 words that I sent Jennifer, she asked me, okay, but what is the problem that these 6 words solve? So I'll tell you the problem then, I think. The problem is that there are overextended artists who have been encouraged to make high quantities of poor quality art for the professional market, and they continue to operate blind in a large, loosely clustered population, isolated from each other, resources, and their geographic neighbors. That's the problem. The solution, these are my 6 words. The first pair is slow down. The second is strategically plan. And the third is collectively organize. And I could go into a little bit of what I mean by those things, but I'd go over my minute. Is that all right?
I think it'd be interesting, actually, if you did.
Okay. So slow down. And this is, Aaron sort of said this already, but repetition, we learn through repetition, right? So make less art for the professional market, okay? And make better quality, more rigorous art. Invest more time in engaging in the community, in seeing art, in discussing art, in getting to know your aesthetic and geographic neighbors. I mean, like, the guy who lives next door to you when I say geographic neighbor. Spend more time being mentored by more established artists. Spend more time advocating for the arts and for your neighbors, learning about aesthetics, about technology and other worldly things, and playing, goofing around in studios and with materials, experimenting with no end goal or necessary outcome. That's what I mean by slow down. By strategically plan, I mean create and follow short and long-term, i.e. 1- and 5-year plans to achieve your vision. Actively cultivate the opportunities that directly feed your vision. Only make work that is true to your unique vision and only you can make. And update your plans each quarter based on a realistic assessment of your progress and changes in the field, but do not let peer or, quote, gatekeeper pressure ever throw you off course. By collectively organize, I mean organize yourselves, your companies, your materials, your financials, your to-do lists, your humans, your ideas. Knowing what you have and being able to easily access it is vital to efficient and productive action. Work collectively along aesthetic and geographic lines to change the way governments, foundations, presenters, and other resource managers allocate their goods. actively help solve issues that plague all of us as citizens, including lack of health care, crappy public transportation, overpriced housing, and underfunded educational systems. Reclaim the ability to discuss aesthetics from the ivory tower of academic authority, the ignorance of the art critic, no offense, Claudia, the cowardice of political correctness, and the fear of elitism. Our work must be both the making of art and the debate of aesthetics. Only then will the audiences follow us comfortably wherever we want to go. And finally, social media are powerful tools for developing rich, compassionate, interpersonal networks, not just for collecting friends to whom we broadcast advertisements for our shows.
Bravely put.
Yeah.
There are so many things in there, and I feel lucky to have known Morgan for so long that I get to hear that kind of talk a lot, and to engage in dialogue like that. I don't know where to start. Does anyone want to jump in with some thought on that, on Morgan's soapbox? We're all stunned. We're like, we're all fear. We're all
really
free
good.
To be
yeah,
ignorant
yeah.
now.
I mean, I think for me, one thing that resonates with what Heather said is about the collectively, like all collectively organizing, feeling empowerment as a group of people, right? Going and showing up at community board meetings. I know you guys hear this, but it's so it breaks my heart when I go to city council hearings that are community affairs hearings, and they're talking about, you know, the struggles that artists are having with the economy, and there's three people from our community in that room. It's like no wonder why the city council doesn't give a damn about us to some extent. We don't show up. We don't pressure them. We don't collectively demonstrate we are a large voting bloc. You must pay attention to us, right? And so that's some of it.
This is something that's come up a lot with Aaron as well, and that idea of like we're not separate. Artists are, you know, all our things about we are low income. We need low income housing. We need this and we need that. We're actually we're part of a huge group, and it is amazing that to go to those meetings and realize that the service organizations are there, other funders are there, but not the actual artists who are so dramatically impacted by these resolutions and laws and legislations and all that. So that's an easy action, takeaway action. Like, where do you live? Who are your assembly people? Get to know them. Live in your community and be active in that way. And you know, I don't mean to be chastising. But if you're going to live here and you want support from this community, then reach out to it.
And I know it feels like, I felt the same pressure, like, but I have so much else I have to do. I have my three jobs to pay my rent, and then I've got to make my show, and I've got to work on this other person's show, and Brian asked a favor of me, so I've got to go to his, and you know, you have like 20 million things, and you're asking me to put this one more thing? You want me to send an email about the MTA transit hikes? I don't have time for that, you know, but like some things are very easy. They take one click. And some things we should start to consider it part of our artistic activity, going to these things and participating in the communities, like so that we stop doing art that's just navel-gazing and that's actually engaged in where we live. I think it's part of it, and it's part of the slowdown, right? If we only make one show every 2 years and we make it with the fundings and the resources that we really think we can manage, then we have a little bit more time for playing with people and also for advocating and for engaging in our communities.
One of the things that that I'm really intrigued by these days is like what you're saying about slow down, think strategically. And Aaron said it very beautifully earlier about if we're constantly in crisis mode, then is it that we're afraid of transformation? I forget exactly what your line is. Like we don't allow ourselves to have that transformation. We don't allow for something else to happen if we're just running around, you know, spinning our wheels all the time. What was your? How did you say it better than I?
Oh, just we don't risk real failure or real transcendence.
Yeah, and Roseanne, in one of my dialogues with Roseanne, yeah. Spradlin was talking about, you know, there are so many showcases that what if you were to go ahead and do a full evening work? What if you were to spend a year and really do that and put yourself out there in a totally, you know, risky way? What would happen then? And that really intrigued me, too.
One of the things that I want to say really quickly is that, you know, Morgan and I have talked a little bit about this. The idea of artists as citizens is really important, I think, to both of us, and I think partly that means separating the fact that sometimes the way we as artists think about the world is a bit different. And sometimes the way we go about our lives is a bit different from people who work a traditional job. What of those are left, you know? At the same time, the issues that are facing us are very much the same. And that's where I think we need to find commonality. And there are plenty of people, you know, I am sometimes a little too stridently against the idea of artists as thinking of ourselves as too exceptional. Like, we're so different, the regular material world doesn't make sense to us. Because I think there are tons of, I know death row lawyers, and I know education activists and housing activists, people who do what they do because they can't not do it, just like we feel. And they're grappling with the same issues. So I do feel like there's a chance for us to join forces without separating from the fact that, yeah, we're kind of kooky compared to the people who work regular jobs. You know, like, we just don't think about the world the same way. But the issues that face us are the same.
You mentioned this middle class, this notion of middle class. And that, I think, is it. There's a recent study that's talking about the demise of the middle class in New York. And, you know, as I'm reading through it, I'm encountering all kinds of issues that affect all of us. And that is the lack of healthcare and the really poor public transportation. I mean, I know we have amazing public transportation. We have a crappy public transportation system in New York that doesn't reach a lot of the places where we live and need to be able to live because rent is so high. You know, it's all. But we're not the only ones who are suffering from that, right? We're not the only ones who should, in theory, or need to be making $90,000 a year in order to be considered middle class as a single individual in the city of New York. There are many other people out there who are also in that state. And so it's connecting to them on those other levels that I think is part of the issue.
We have to move on now. I heard Moira sigh over there, but I'm going to say, we'll sigh later. Brian. Roger.
She guessed. All right, mine is really short. And I'll just say as a preface that these are not things that I necessarily believe, but there are things that we should discuss. There are no real gatekeepers anymore. Artists have power. Art education is not a substitute for art. Stay small, do less, do one thing really well, and that's it. Is there really a shortage of space in New York? No, there is not. Mm-hmm. And finally, the for-profit world should be coming to us for advice, not the other way around. And that's all I have to say.
Well.
What advice? Go ahead.
No, anyone? Anyone on the panel has a response? I like the brevity a lot. It's
I want to pick, because we've had this conversation before about space, right? And, and there's all of these organizations out there that are like, we need more art spaces, we need more art spaces. And I know that, to some extent, Robert, you're involved in some of that conversation as well. And so I just wonder if maybe the two of you could play on that for a moment. Like, my personal view is we don't need more art spaces, we need better resourced current spaces, and we need more spaces for artists to live, but...
Right. I think that there's very little smart thinking on a lot of levels about what it means to have a space, not just in New York, but anywhere, and what the impact of that actually is on the ability of an arts organization, especially a small arts organization, to function productively and honor its mission. I think, in a certain way, one of the real indicators of, I think, how the arts economy has failed is in, and Claudia wrote about this in this article, this wave of mid-sized arts organizations taking on massive debt loads to finance big buildings that they were told they could not afford internally and did anyway. So just on that level, I think there's a real potential for real estate to cripple artists, not to help them. And at the same time, there really isn't like this huge overflowing wealth of artistic stuff to put in these spaces. I know that in my space, I feel like I'm competing. And I hate the idea that I'm competing, but in a way I am competing with Vallejo and with Carla and with a lot of other people to find really interesting stuff, or stuff that's interesting to me, because that's subjective, but to put and to support. And I think it would actually be really, in a certain way, it would actually be really great if some of these places just went away.
Smackdown.
Smackdown.
Well, I think, I mean, my opinion of space in New York City is, you know, last year when we had a field panel here, I was recommending that everybody move to Berlin because New York was too expensive at that point. And, you know, we lost 25% of our off-Broadway theaters, off-Broadway theater infrastructure. New York can be expensive, but it has to include narrative or opportunity in its narrative, or the city's only expensive. And now we've subtracted all the freelance employment, you know, that was really, in many ways, helping to sustain the artistic community. And the, you know, I'm not convinced of the decisions that the city's made with respect to, you know, helping Yankee Stadium be reborn, or, you know, the state and the city participating in the Lincoln Center renovation. You know, I think that New York really needs venues where audiences can walk in easily, where they can form community around the artists that they present, and where there's opportunity for young artists to participate and to gravitate to a city like New York, which for the last 50 years brought the one smartest kid from everywhere to this city, and with them came a lot of freedom. And Berlin is now about to become the New York City of the United States of Europe. And I'm still very, very bullish on Berlin and think that Berlin and New York are actually very beautiful counterpoints to each other with regard to their ability to draw people to themselves and then to allow ideas to be created and to then be disseminated back out to their own cultures. And, you know, the fear I have for the city, for this city, is that we don't have enough spaces where you can get your work on a wall or your foot on a stage. And, you know, for this I would advocate, as we have been, an expansion of the 421A housing program to include ground floor cultural infrastructure. So I would say more space, but I would say targeted more to spaces where audiences can make community around the artists that are presented.
Right. Or I could even revise my statement to say more small artist-run spaces run by people who understand what it means to do that, and less behemoths that are sort of like the nonprofit equivalent of the bank that's too big to fail. You know, I think we've got a bunch of those in New York. CIGs. And that's even like there's a CIGs. You know, there's a lot of organizations wrapped up in that term, and some of them are really. I mean, I don't want to judge them. I just think that there is a degree. I think it's really blatantly true that small independent artists and small arts organizations are actually subsidizing larger arts organizations, and then of course, you know, the real estate developers, because we're subsidizing them too. But
should we move on?
Excellent.
Are you ready?
So I just want to say that I agree entirely with everything, every word that has been said, so despite what you're about to hear. No, I'm kidding. So as I said, I think we have all agreed that the funding model that we have in place right now has got major problems, and they've been wonderfully enumerated on the blog and also here. So I'm going to add my own two cents on that very quickly, although I don't think that the problems with the model itself are the problem. So I think that one of the problems with the model is that it causes a kind of schizophrenia, and maybe we've talked about this already, but so I think that if you were raised in this culture, and pretty much probably in the Western Hemisphere, you carry in your bones this habit of a market economy, and that it's very, very hard to strip yourself of that instinct or that habit. But, of course, if you choose to work in the arts world, if you're an artist especially, but if you're even an arts worker, you're not operating in a market economy. You're not operating in a supply-demand economy, period. It's an artificial economy. It's completely different. And I feel like that needs to be made very clear to anybody who's considering going into the arts world, you know, students or whatever. So the fact that it's not made clear, it seems to elicit this kind of schizophrenia. Like, there's this frustration, like, what I'm doing is good. Why is it not being recognized as such financially? But you just got to go talk to the banker if that's what you're talking about. That's not the exchange that's going on within the arts economy. Okay. Lots of problems with that. The way I position myself in this, okay, so I don't know what the solution to knocking down the model is. Wait, I just had a thought when you guys were talking, and then I'll shut up. I'm sorry. No. It's like the supply-demand thing. what I think is that we need to raise consciousness, not only for artists, but for every citizen, no matter what class they're in, so that they are ready to take in the arts as a part of the supply-demand economy. I don't think that the supply-demand economy is going to go away. And I don't think, unless the citizens of this country are on a cellular level understanding the dimensions, you know, that you inhabit as an artist and the meaning of that, I don't think this problem's ever going to go away. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the way I position myself in terms of, okay, so this is an answer to what do we do about this? The way I position myself in terms of this not knowing, because I feel like there's a not knowingness, like what do we do about this effort to raise consciousness, and I believe, again, this touches everybody, is to, essentially, now I hear it as slow down, like observe and babble instead of make sentences that make sense, as you can hear tonight. because I think in the babbling, it's just exactly the same thing that you do in creating a piece of work, you know? In the babbling comes that new form, and we can't know what that form is now. I know that it's not 1965 New York City. I know that it's not 19th century Italy or, you know, 16th century Italy. We don't know what it is yet. It's unrecognizable to us. So how do we train ourselves to observe and babble? I think that's slowing down, and also do it together. Yeah. So it's really connecting all of those things that you were saying. My last thing, and I have to say this now after sitting through this, is that part of the reason, so I hate the word funder. It's not a word. It's not in the dictionary. Thank you. And the reason I hate it is, firstly, it's ugly, right? It sounds like somebody wanted to say fucker, but instead they said funder. And the other thing is that it conflates the identity of an individual with an institution. It's a terrible, terrible thing to do to somebody like me. And it doesn't address the problem. I mean, it doesn't articulate what you're trying to say when you use that word funder. So I say ban funder. Okay, that's it.
One of the things I'm curious about, because I got to read your thing beforehand, was about, you said it's definitely not European. It's not the European model. That's not where we're headed. And I think often in our community we say, God, if we just had government subsidies like Europe, or, oh, God, if we just had that. And then there's a counterpoint of, but then would we get lazy, or would we get complacent? Or, you know, Aaron obviously wants to say something.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I just think we're too sprawling and unruly a country to manage from one central source. So I've been lucky enough to be in 6 cities in the last 3 weeks. I just realized this, including Missoula, Montana, Austin, Texas, San Diego, Portland, and Tucson. And was in the middle of the arts communities in all those places, and they're radically different. They have radically different ecosystems and radically different needs. And, you know, in Missoula, there's a guy who makes beautiful sculptures and also ranches 400 head of cattle. So having an art czar, which, like, the czars were people that did terrible things to people, so I'm not a big fan of that. Having an art czar for the whole country seems like a mistake. So I feel like that is sort of based on a European model. I don't know what the model is. I think the diversity of funding sources actually, if there were more capital, would serve us well. I just don't think there's enough money in any of the sources.
I've been actually listening to these lectures online about the environment and things like that, and everything seems to be focused on mayors and on thinking about shifting our view towards the megalopolis away from the NEA. So the NEA or the national, we all know who Obama is, but we can't touch him, and we can touch Scott Stringer, who's our Manhattan Borough president. You know, like just thinking a little bit more on the like manageable local scale. And that doesn't mean forgetting the federal, but just focusing in on who we have really direct access to, because in fact, they have a lot more power over our lives than Obama does, for example, as fantastic as he may or may not be.
Well, I can't speak for anyone else here, but I mean, I think that for like the circle of organizations of my size, the NEA is completely irrelevant because we're not getting money from them. So it'd be nice to, but it's not going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen in the near future. And it's one thing about local politics that's it's bad and it's good. And I spend an inordinate amount of my time thinking about this is local politics. In New York, local politicians do have access to funds, and a lot of the ways that money gets transferred into the hands of arts organizations is really just because it's politically expeditious for a city council member, or, you know, to support an organization in their district because that organization has a lot of pull. And so they don't do it necessarily because they have this love of the arts, but they know that they need to be seen to support that thing. And I think if artists and arts organizations understood that relationship, right, I'm sure they understand it, if they were willing to sort of accept it more, they would exploit it more, and there would be actually more money flowing than we have now.
There's an interesting model. Haley Radigan, who I work with here at Galapagos, mentioned that in Dallas, there's a 3% tax on hotel stays, and that goes to supporting sports. I'm not sure what that means, sports in Dallas, but, you know, it's the Cowboys or it's something. But, you know, what if New York City were to have a 3% hotel tax on culture or for culture or something? You know, there's lots of models available. Are we ready to end our first?
Yeah, so slide? I lied a little bit because I said you guys would have an opportunity to do some questioning, but because the surprise needs to happen at a surprising time, we're going to cut off the question and answer for now, but hold all your big questions. And I just wanted, because I'm a control freak, I wanted to do a little bit like, oh, these are things that I take away from what just happened, because it's so much happening and so much smartness. And I wrote down the fear of naming money and naming our price, less with more, make fewer shows, make them better, take yourself super seriously, the artist as a citizen, find our commonality. Supply and demand won't go away. How do we raise our consciousness to act for ourselves and think and act locally? So those are things that I'm doing my little takeaway from. I do want to give a rousing applause for these lovely, smart people.
So now Pete, if we could bring these lights down here, and we're very lucky, one of our resident artists, Lisa Natoli, is going to perform for us. And Galapagos is a venue that is incredibly lucky to have an aerialist in residence. Lisa Natoli. So remember, our job is to double her audience in a year and to pay her rent by the end of 1 year.
It all happens. Ow!
I can see my nose.
Ow!
Candid or not?
Beards only.
Don't fall down.
Beards, non-beards.
Excellent, and we're back.
Yay!
On the housekeeping front, we did a little raffle, and we did this financial survey. We asked you guys to fill it out, and Young Soon Kim is the winner of a complimentary cocktail.
Yay!
Please go to the bar, and Michael Helland will buy you a drink.
Ooh.
I also made a tactical error in panel number one, which is that we didn't introduce the panelists, so some of you are totally in the dark about who those smart people were. So I see Aaron Landsman right here. Aaron Landsman is right there. Aaron wears multiple hats, from artist to arts administrator to ERS, elevator repair service, creative capital, super, super, super multi-hat wearer. Brian Rogers over there.
Yay!
Artist, provocateur, chocolate factory founder, and $1.95 worker. We also have, where are my other friends? Moira Brennan, Map Fund. Where's Moira? Moira Brennan, somewhere in the bathroom, perhaps. And who am I? Oh, Morgan Von Prell Pacelli. Woo! Anthropologist. Yes, she's a PhD. Almost in anthropology at Columbia. She's an artist. She's worked at Ontological, 3LD. She has her own company. She does everything. So that's great. Thank you, you guys.
Should we go to Ben?
Oh, yes. Sorry, we have something exciting, a surprise, up here. Now.
That's our new website, by the way. It was launched today.
That's right, I thought it was six.
If I remember that just 1 year ago, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were still locked in the dead heat for the presidential nomination, General Motors was happily cranking out Hummers, Sarah Palin was unknown outside of the frozen north, and the Dow Jones closed at 12,348, 5,000 points higher than today. How much can change in just one quick year? With the devastating plunge in the national economy, we now face a future collectively that feels more uncertain, more paralyzing, and more daunting than any in my lifetime, at least. And certainly we know the theater and artists have felt the plunge as acutely as many, as any. Already, many of you have seen individual giving drop late in 2008. Comparable drops in government and corporate giving are likely to be felt this year, indeed, a year in which both those sectors could go into freefall. And in foundation giving, where I work at the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, the drop will begin to be felt, although the erosion will be more gradual, since many foundations, like our own, bases giving budgets on a 24 to 36 month average of assets, meaning that the true drop won't be felt until 2010 or beyond. Already, many of you have taken 10 to 15% preemptive cuts in current year budgets and are planning to take as large a cut again for the coming year. And let's face it, we can all sit down together and recite the litany of traditional solutions: staff downsizing, hiring freezes, reduced programming, whether in number of shows, scale, or length of events, elimination or radical reduction in employee benefits, if there are any to have it in the first place, hikes in ticket prices, and at last resort, fire sale, a list that increasingly feels to many of us futile and insufficient. As an arts community, therefore, it's absolutely right and imperative that this is the time we come together to explore vital new strategies for the future. We have to be thoughtful and sincere and committed about partnerships and collaborations, shared services, reduction of duplicated efforts, the possibilities of mergers, including potentially mergers across discipline lines and mergers involving complementary rather than duplicative organizations, like a playwright development program merging with a producing theater. As David's already said, we have to be creative in substance and approach, and I hope tonight we'll take seriously the words of Bill Moyers when he says, creativity is easy, it means four things. You show up, you really show up, senses vibrating, you listen deeply, you speak the truth, and you let go of predetermined results. In a time when scarcity of resources can heighten the competitive urge and it can be really easy for us to turn on one another, we've got to elevate the discourse to the arts ecology, remembering that praising theater while disparaging dance or opera, or arguing for the avant-garde while disparaging the mainstream, or pleading the case of the small at the expense of the large, advantages nobody and harms us all. The future, as Barry Nailbuff at Yale has said, is about co-opetition, cooperating to grow the pie for everyone, even while it's inevitable that we'll compete for our piece of it. And frankly, as has already been said, this week has proven the strength of that approach, with the return of that $50 million earmark for the arts in the federal economic recovery legislation, an earmark that was eliminated by the Senate but later restored as a result of focused advocacy, activism, and a carefully articulated sense of our importance to our communities. We need to grab every lesson we can from that: the value of a strategic, coordinated message, the value of data in building our cases, the power of celebrity spokespeople on our behalf. Thank God Robert Redford called Nancy Pelosi. I'm telling you. And the dedication, not least of all, of our boards and our political allies. In this time, we have to approach lawmakers not with palms outstretched saying this is what we need for the government. We need to approach the government confident and proud, ready to articulate what we will do for the world, because we are not part of the problem. We are part of the solution. We will employ, we will reach into the educational system, we will stimulate tourism and more. Arguments based on action that establishes us as participants in solving problems, not in creating them. All this said, I'd be remiss if I would suggest that the financial is the only crisis we face. Even before the economy bottomed out, we were getting together annually to talk about annual audience erosion, lamenting the decline of subscriptions, the growing rate of churn, for those of you that know that term, and the tendency of single ticket buyers to purchase at shorter and shorter intervals of time. We were bemoaning the rampant effects of technology, Technology not only as competition for leisure time, but as a shaper of consumer expectation and psychology, training us all to believe we can shop at 8 at night or 3 in the morning and that custom-made products will arrive at our own homes. Advantages of consumption that we in the performing arts, with set curtain times, set venues, attendant inconveniences of price and transportation and more, simply cannot reach. And we lamented the effect of technology on economics, asking what will it mean when we ask a young person to pay $40, $50, or $60 for a theater ticket, when that young person is used to downloading culture on demand 24 hours a day on the internet for 99 cents a song or for free. I could argue to us all that the crisis we face in the arts is not financial at all. We are in a seismic, fundamental redefinition of culture and communication in this country, a redefinition that has left recorded music industry in disarray. It's threatening bookstores and newspapers and traditional broadcast media. And in a world of technology, changing demographics, and globalism, the crisis we truly face is a crisis of relevance and urgency. The financial merely redefines the resources we bring to bear.
Ben, that's Ben Cameron, and he was out of town, so we brought Ben Cameron. That's Ben Cameron. He's the program director, I believe, is his title, at the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, and just an incredibly aggressive and boisterous speaker who has no troubles at all getting his point across. He's really a brilliant speaker, and that was a very enlightening meeting to be at. So we thought that would be something that was a very important message to bring to this.
And that was the meeting of community boards 1 through 5 that was held, I think, in March, if I remember. And it's one of those meetings that you really should attend. It was titled The Collapse of the Small and Emerging Theater Community in New York. And literally it was, I mean, you saw the mega panel they had. It was, you know, politicians and service organization people. But as Morgan said earlier, I didn't notice that many artists in the house, and they were really talking about issues that are super relevant to all of us. So I encourage you to find out who is your community board and to let them get to know you as well. So thank you, Ben Cameron. On to panel number 2, cultural entrepreneurs.
Yay, cultural entrepreneurs.
Because we were remiss before, I want to do a quick down the line, super slowly articulating your name and your company or your title, I suppose.
I'm Roseanne Spradlin. I'm a choreographer, independent.
I'm Jeff Nilica. I work in a collaborative group called Feast, which is funding emerging art with sustainable tactics. And I also work with Julia Mandel.
I'm John Stancato. I'm the producing artistic director of the Stolen Chair Theater Company.
I'm Rachel Chafkin. I am the artistic director of The Team.
I'm Miguel Gutierrez. I'm an artist. I make pieces.
Miguel, do you want to start with your soapbox? We'll have the same rules, one at a time.
I talk too much.
Not Miguel. Don't start with Miguel. Roseanne. The fear factor.
I have to put on my glasses, okay. I mean, when I look out, I feel like I don't know so many of you, so I'm assuming maybe you don't know me either, so that's okay. I've been in New York since the mid-80s, though, so I've kind of seen some different stages go by. I guess that's partly why I was asked to be on this panel. I wrote my little thing. I start out with a quote. I don't know exactly how to pronounce this critic's name. Peter Sheldahl? Anyway, he wrote a review or article recently in the New Yorker about the 1970s visual artists reviewing this show called Pictures. And there was one sentence in there I just loved. And it is, the artists turned out to be unhurtable, as artists, like cats, generally are. The above sentence caught my eye because it made me think of the New York dance scene in 2009, dance as usual being about 30 years behind the times. Sorry. And what we're engaged in doing right now, sincere, well-meaning people trying to get a grasp on what is happening and what needs to be done to fix the downtown dance scene. To the stakeholders, I want to say, so here at the beginning is the nugget of my manifesto. Don't try to control artists. Don't try to herd us. Don't try to tell us what kind of work we should make or what our interests should be. Let artists figure it out for themselves and then give your support to what they do. I believe we are in an extended time of transition, and it's not clear right now what's going to happen and which way New York dance is going to go. But I think we should give it time and let the artists figure it out. We can create something new. We don't have to feel obliged to recycle ideas handed over from the European dance scene, which in reality are often ideas recycled from American dance of the 1960s and 70s. And we don't have to kowtow to the marketplace. But, and then to the artists, I say, dance people do need to grow up and take responsibility for their training, for developing their voice, and for learning about the world at large. It is no longer possible for the downtown dance community to exist as a parallel economy. Living in New York as an artist should be a grown-up job. Develop your voice, create a serious body of work, and show it to the public. Don't always take the easy way out, showing your work in endless showcases and keeping up an endless round of group activities. Don't depend so much on the various service organizations to create opportunities for you. Go out and create them for yourself. Take a bigger risk, be brave, self-produce a full evening of work rather than participating in another showcase. Some other obvious points: funding amounts need to double just to keep up with inflation. I saw a sign on the subway today that says $1 in 1986 is equivalent to $1.89 today. So what does that tell us about the typical $7,000 to $10,000 grants and fellowships that we get? It means they should be $15,000 to $20,000 just to keep up with inflation, right? I want to say, I'm not too offensive in saying this, but I do feel like there are some institutions, and I'm going to name them, the Joyce Theater, BAM, and even the Kitchen at times, that are pulling against the progress of dance in New York City. We need to take a look at this, and I think we need to change it. You know, and if there are rifts that have happened in the past, somebody needs to try to work through those things. This, I'm kind of reiterating what was said by the other panel, the first panel. We need a bigger voice, and we need to speak out nationally about funding and respect for the arts. There is enough for everyone if funds are distributed equitably. Let's not give in to the argument that people need to eat before they need to look at art, because it's not an either-or situation. And finally, I say it's okay for artists to gaze at their navels. We shouldn't let people chastise us for navel gazing. And why? Because everything on the outside came from the inside. Inside, outside are very much alike. And the most important thing for an artist is to know herself or know himself. And if you don't know yourself, you're really not going to have anything to say. Okay.
You guys know that you can pipe up whenever you want to, and I'll start the pipe, which is just, Roseanne, absolutely one of the reasons why I wanted you here tonight was your sense of history and knowledge and the awareness that a lot, the emerging community we assume is younger, and that's just not true at all, and how do we support intergenerational art and just also what happens mid-career, because you are, according to most of our benchmarks, successful in terms of getting certain grants and press and shows of the kitchen. And I'm sure many in this audience, if you look up to you and think that you are where they want to be, and I don't know how you would even respond to that, you know, that you're a paradigm or a model that someone would want to step into, you know? Because I know also, you know, we fiscally sponsor you, and you are an anomaly in what we think of as the ladder that people are going to move up. That once you're getting certain grants from the MAP Fund or from Creative Capital or from Jerome Greenwald, that you will get your own 501c3, that you will get a board of directors, that you will do all of these things. And you haven't done that, and that's very curious. You're sort of, you know, doing it your own way. That's my own little soapbox for a second about Roseanne Spradlin.
Yeah, somehow I figured out some things and didn't figure out others, so. but yeah, I have been successful getting grants, but I want to say I worked my fucking ass off. Like, I didn't just... and for years, I mean, I really tried to learn how to write grant proposals, and I think that maybe not everyone is willing to do that. I mean, you really have to work hard to learn... how do you get funding? Of course, the other side of that is that you're still emerging. I mean, I'm still, I don't know, it's like I still don't have very much, and I'm being audited by the IRS because of having like 2 years of getting some of the bigger grants, and like now I'm getting audited, and like that just seems so unfair. Well, I know that happened to
Miguel. It happened to me.
To me,
it happens to a lot of artists.
Part of the problem seems to be on at least on the funding side, and not that this is just about funders, but there's a huge vacuum between some of these grants and actually how to. And Morgan talks a lot about this in the blog as well. Like, how do you support long-term art making if you don't start building the revenue that maybe will take place of some of those grants? But there aren't enough grants to really support the creative process or to support long-term sustainability. And you seem to really hit that wall. And I think Miguel probably, even though you're in a different stage, has similar. Funding issues, correct?
Yeah, I mean, a grant is just a certain amount of cash that goes away. Like, it's like, it's quickly. Not like, it's not an anointing by the gods, you know, that like, now therefore you are taken care of for the next 50. I mean, it's like, and most grants aren't enough to cover the cost of what you're doing. And, you know, we're in dance. It's like, we're not all making solos, you know, like, you know, if you're trying to pay people, you know, as was discussed on the first panel, a equitable fee, you know. I mean, I don't want to interject too much here, but like a show that I did 2 years ago, Everyone, the real budget for that show was like $180,000, right? The real budget for that, we got like $60,000. That was the first time I was able to pay people an hourly rate. I did a tiered rate based on the people that worked for me for a longer time versus the new people. And it was $10 an hour and $15 an hour for 12 hours a week. And I got all these grants, and people were like, oh my God, it's so amazing. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's like relative. It's like, yes, it's amazing. I'm trying to pay people. You know, it's like, you know, if I really go on what I have, this is what we can actually afford to pay people, you know? And I compared that to a friend of mine who was living and working in Berlin, and that, you know, it's laughable. That's like 2 days of full work, full-time, not even full-time work, a week. You know, so I just want to put it out there that these grants are, I mean, they're great, please, more and more. But, you know, like, they're not the savior either,
right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, what's sort of missing from the grant package idea is that there's never any money to actually give to the choreographer,
yeah.
Unfortunately. So, like, there's just like a blankness about how does a choreographer actually make money to live? Because when you get a grant, you're not supposed to give it to yourself. You're supposed to give it to everyone else. You know, your composers, your dancers, your set designers, your accountant, all of that. And there's never any for you.
But that's, I mean, isn't that just the way you write it? Like, if you structure yourself, your labor is part of the budget, so absolutely, that's not general operating expenses. That's part of the project budget. So
some of the grants actually specify we want to fund salaries for dancers. They do, actually. They don't want you to just give it to yourself. So.
I just like to compliment you on the metaphor of navel, umbilical, inside out. That was a beautiful.
thanks.
She's an artist.
And also budgets change. Like, you know, you have a budget and you think it's going to be a certain way, and then the reality comes and that thing didn't come through. And actually, I think costs a whole lot more than you thought it did. And who's going to take the cut? You know, like you or, you know, it's your freaking project.
I think, too, that a lot of what Roseanne said, she was saying dance and choreography, but we could just replace that with theater artists or music artists. There are odd shifts between the theater world and the dance world in certain ways, and for-profit and non-profit. The theater world often has a larger radar in terms of the for-profit, non-profit specter than the dance world does. But most of the issues, I think, are completely common in terms of, it's, again, that fear of maybe naming your price or some of those issues.
I mean, I don't know if it is realistic, but when people are talking about NEA, my thought is, why don't we all march in the streets and say, restore the artists' fellowships from NEA? I think that could be a possibility, because that might be something that you guys don't even remember, but when I first moved to New York, there were individual artists' fellowships. They were $7,000, and people said, we could pay our rent for a year on that fellowship. But what about if they were $20,000 now, and you could get them for 5 years in a row before you had to reapply again? You know, it's like, let's have some real money, you know? Maybe we should go on.
On that note, yeah, we're going to move on to Jeff, whose last name I can't pronounce.
Nilika.
It's Nilika. It means rotten fruit in Czechoslovakian. It's for real. These are things that I believe in. I believe in the Christ-itunity. I believe in creating queer economies and in bottom-up cultural production. I believe in shifting the art economy away from luxury goods and boutique experience and government subsidy and towards self-sustainable tactics. I believe in sustainable tactics like collectivism, localism, completed cycles, cooperatives, and slow design. I believe parties are a lot more fun and people are sexier and conversation is more interesting when people don't have much to lose. I believe most nonprofits operate like for-profits. I believe that we are all artist, we are all patron, audience, activist, and curator. I believe in barter, alternative currency, and microcredit. I believe in a post-growth, slow economy. I believe in going offline. I believe that children are the future. And that they're really good at working in online communities, and that it's up to us to set up systems that work towards thoughtful, sustainable art making. I believe that we are all emerging. I believe in Pete Seeger. And I believe in participation. I believe that economies are nothing more than populations participating in a value system within a specific time frame. I believe that that population is us, and the value system is sustainability, and the time frame is now.
Ow!
And that's nothing that I wrote you.
Jeff wrote me that he was going to have you guys stand up, take a dollar out of your wallet, throw it in the air, and then try to get some more money.
That's something very, like that. It didn't work out.
Which we could still
There was
do.
Origami involved. Yeah. It changed. I wrote this instead.
We could still do that. But, yeah. But dive in, some smart person on this panel, about Jeff. And
I can talk more, too.
I really like your attack on the word emerging. Emerging has been a sort of crippling word for, I know, our organization and a lot of other organizations I've spoken with, because you're never emerging, and then suddenly you're post-career, and there's this weird period where we're not eligible for emerging opportunities, and then all of a sudden we're too old to get them, and I'm already feeling that moving towards my late 20s, which is pathetic. So I think the idea of sort of recasting that for everybody, that's that.
Just wait.
It's a really lovely idea.
Well, I think that's part of the problem with that was an impulse for us to start Feast. Feast is really new, so I don't know if people know about it. Basically, we have a big dinner in Greenpoint where people pay a door donation, and we have about 10 projects around the room. People get dinner and a ballot, and whoever gets the most money walks away with the money at the end of the night. Then they come back the next month and show what they've been working on. And one of the major impulses behind creating that was sort of a frustration with the granting system. Part of it was that grants catered towards non-multidisciplinary artists, right? That you are a choreographer and you make dance work, and those are the grants that you can apply for. Or you are in another, you know, you're a visual artist, and those are the grants you can apply for. But also, the time frame that you had to apply for them, that at a certain point you stopped being able to get money, and for some reason, after 5 years, they thought you would have figured out how to subsidize, like, 50% of your operating budget. So, yeah, I mean, I think that was a big part.
And I was speaking to Jeff before the panel, I'm sorry, but I asked him if he had a good mix of philanthropists and artists showing up at his feast events, and he sort of shot me a look to say that he wants them to be both at the same time, and I was really, really impressed by that, and the fact that I was still trapped in this binary with all the thinking I try to do about these issues. I still see artists and sort of those that want to fund art and support art as two distinct communities, and I like that Jeff's trying to conflate them and throw them together.
And Julie and I were talking today. She's at the Park Slope Co-op, and we looked at a lot of sort of sustainable food practice, food production models to use those towards cultural production. And yeah, and she was saying how, you know, because you have to work the front desk, you know, you're doing the checkout. When you're actually going and getting checked out, you have this sense of empathy, right? And I think blurring those roles that we've created for ourselves, that if you go to Feast three times and you're a funder, you know, you're an audience member, when you go as an artist, you have this whole new empathy for the decision-making process that goes into the grant-making. Or, you know, I think you can see all those different parts of it. And it's so bizarre to me how isolated those places, you know, if you are a curator, you are not an artist. You know, if you do those things, they have to be totally separate in your life. Or if you are a funder, you shouldn't be telling the artist what your opinions are of their artwork. Or you have to do it in this really sort of like hidden, weird way. So we were just kind of wanted to experiment with that.
Super.
Rah! Now throw your money. Throw
exactly,
your
money.
Can I just interject something, though? I mean, I think everything you're saying is really beautiful, but I feel like I feel a little overwhelmed from hearing you and then hearing stuff that the first panel says. It's like, how many more fucking things do I have to become? You know, it's like, I have to become a business person, I have to become an advocate, I have to become a philanthropist, I have to become an advocate. I'm not like, can I just like make a really, really good fucking show? Like, can I just get really good at one thing? You know, I mean, you know, it's like, we have to go to the board meeting, then I have to go to the grant, then I have to do the thing, then I have to go to the, it's like, I'm like, who's got the time? And I have to take 2 years to make a piece. It's like, with what fucking money? You know, am I going to wait 2 years to make a show? Thank you very much. You know, it's like, I mean, I'm just putting it out there. You know, it's just like, it's just, I feel like it's also, at least in dance, this pernicious voluntarism that gets into things like, we have to take it all on. You know, we're at the bottom, so we have to take it all on. You know, and it's like, and I mean, I just want to put that out there. You know, sometimes I'm just like, I mean, I noticed that when I started getting more successful, suddenly it's like I'm being invited to this panel, I'm being into da da da, and I was like, I just want to be weird. Like, I just want to spend more time reading, fucking, like making bad decisions about both of those things. You know, like, you know, I want to, like, you know, it's like, there's sometimes, you know, there's like this sense of like, I have to become this like multi-beveled superhuman, you know, in order to survive in this thing. And I reject, you know, the rugged individualist model of the artist, but I do have to say, like, I envy too somehow, you know, a sense of dropping down in one place. You know, the depth. I feel like there's just like this sense of this constant multiplicity.
It's called stay home more.
Yeah. I mean, and I try. I mean, I just want to counter it to see how you.
No, but I guess what we're trying to experiment with too, and it is. I see the problem, but you know, like, why does right now you have to take 5 days out of your life and write this grant, right? It's so separate from your practice. You know that that why can't you start to try to create a system where the funding is part of the practice? You know I don't know if what we're doing is the right answer, but it doesn't make sense to me that you should have these, you know, in the same way that the roles are separated, that the way you're funding yourself is totally separated from what you're doing. I think the more that you integrate it and make it a participant, make the money a participant in what you're doing, you're...
But what artist is not writing their own grants, Jeff? Like, who isn't spending
that? No, I'm saying get out of that system. Like, but find another system.
Find another way to make
money. Can I say something? I mean, I'm totally behind what you're doing.
Yeah.
But Steve Gross, who started the field many years ago, said this to me once when I was complaining about the time it takes to write a grant. And he goes, yeah, but if you get it, you've made $500 an hour, you know, for the amount of time that you put in it. Like, how else are you going to ever make that much money?
Yeah.
You know, so if you get good at it,
yeah,
and you get the funding, then it's worth the amount of time.
But if you lump together all the hours you spend writing all the grants, then it comes down to $1.75 an hour.
In the beginning, you don't get that many, but once you start to get them, then you get more.
I wish it were a meritocracy like that, but I'm not quite sure it is. I'm not sure. It's just an endurance game, and it's just about how much work you put in and how good your work is, because I think there are sort of these barriers that become difficult to penetrate.
It's like anything else. Like, you know, it reflects somewhat the amount of time and effort that you put into it. I mean, it sucks, too,
yeah.
So I'm not, like,
Well, the other
as a way to go, but...
We've had huge conversation about supply and demand as well, that there, you know, there are so many people going after the same grants now. Like, I don't even know the numbers, but the supply of art, you know, is exponential. You know, at the field we see how many people are going for MAP grants, how many people are trying for DCA, how many people are trying for NISCA. You know, I do think that, you know, yes, persevere, yes, stick to it, but the reality is, like, it's just shrinking. And truthfully, with the economy, it's getting worse. So what can we do differently? Because there's just not enough. Yes, I absolutely stay in it. As a fiscal sponsor who, like, you know, we make our money off of, like, you guys writing your grants, it's a little retarded for me to say stop writing your grants. But we often question that internally. Like, what are we doing promoting this system that doesn't seem to work for the majority of artists that come to us seeking help? We're saying, yes, learn how to write grants. Yes, go do this. Yes. And then we're going, oh, but there aren't any grants. What are you going to do? So
it's also just like, it's like applying to college over and over and over and over again. It's like, here's my safety school. Here's my, like, you know.
Are there safety grants? I want one.
Yeah, I mean, no, actually there isn't. But, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, but it's sort of the same thing as doing shows. You know, it's like, who, you know, what space am I having intercourse with this year? You know, like, you know, like, who, you know, I mean, as Moira said, these are, I hope I'm quoting her, like, artificial economies, you know, and there's no guarantee. I mean, you know, I think it's fascinating and also frustrating that we have to think in a community way when we're asking for money. You know, these are consortium models that we have to construct, you know, and I don't know. You know, I, of course, I'm always like, can't there just be one fucking application? Like, can't there be one? It's like, this one, you have to be like, I'm a little bit more blue, you know, I'm a little bit more red, you know. It's all the same thing. It's all going to the same stupid piece, you know. And it's like, oh, but this piece is really about your interest, grant maker, you know. And this issue of authenticity, I think, is so huge, too. And I think it's, what I think is exciting about what Jeff's saying is, like, the immediacy of the accountability. You know, it's like,
I mean,
here it is.
It's funny, it's just, but there's, like, two big pieces of just immediacy, right? That, like, one of the things that we're talking about is, you know, this idea of, like, seasonal, you know, in the food world, it's seasonal produce, like, local seasonal produce, and being farm fresh. And, like, how can we make studio fresh grants, right? Like, why am I writing a grant in 2005 and then by the time I implement a program, it's 2008? It doesn't make sense, especially in our world. And that is a big thing. You said something else smart, but I forget what you said.
I'm actually going to cut this off and say we're going to continue this portion because it's awesome and obviously there's a lot of heat around it, but I'm going to move us on to
to John.
So I, like Aaron, also teach kids how to speak publicly, and I'm going to do it very badly right now with my prepared notes. So Jennifer had asked us all to address the current state of the arts economy, and as I sat down wrestling with this idea and trying to do this, I realized that none of us should really be in this room talking about the arts economy because it doesn't exist. Non-commercial arts, by their very definition, don't follow market logic and can't compete in the marketplace without dependence on nonprofit support structures and the government. So we can embrace our roles in the margins of the economy and struggle and starve the way performing artists have struggled and starved since religion and theater parted ways centuries ago. Or we can model ourselves on two of the only other positions left to us in a market-driven economy, charity, like an endangered species, or as a community resource, like a neighborhood garden. Well, if we're a charity, we should follow the model of other charities. Humpback whales do not send out end-of-year asks or write grant applications, so we should not either. We should depend entirely upon the goodwill of people who don't want to imagine a world without theater and therefore raise awareness, funds, and support to ensure we continue to exist. But I don't want to be a charity in large part because I don't think our social cause has enough merit to compete with other charities who actually change lives on a grand scale. So the... I believe in art.
Self-hating.
Bring it, bring it.
Smackdown.
No. I'm going to detour for a moment to say that we were just in a competition for social media prize from the Genzebar Foundation against the National Association Against the Death Penalty. So it was the Stolen Chair Theater Company versus the national organization trying to end the death penalty. And I'm sorry, but I don't feel that our mission is as viable as that, as much as I'd like to. Okay. So I am. So the only other round hole I think we can force our square peg of a business model into is as a community resource. In this interconnected digital age, if our art can serve as a meeting place for communities of like-minded individuals to connect, celebrate, and be challenged, then we might find a way of restoring theater's primacy in people's lives and creating sustainable theater-making organisms, not organizations. And a couple other things I just want to add very, very quickly, shoot these off. Why is there now, why has there been, and why will there always be prime, beautiful, ready-to-be-theatricalized real estate sitting vacant for extended periods in all five boroughs? If someone can work out the issues with insurance, tax deductions, box office splits, zoning laws, all that, so that businesses have a reason to open their doors to artists, then we could do what we do best, which is drive in droves of foot traffic with expendable cash who might be looking to rent a new office or storefront. 80% of my company's budget goes towards space rental. If we knock that out or reduce it, we can pay our artists a competitive hourly wage. The other thing is I sort of rage against is this idea of, oh, why don't you just make a quid pro quo arrangement with a church and then you could borrow their space and all this idea of these quid pro quos. And I work with a company of a lot of people who are freelancers and get paid by the hour. And if they're going to be using these quid pro quo hours instead of their own hours, where they're going to be making much less doing exchanges for the church, it just seems counterproductive. And we might as well be just working an extra hour at our freelance jobs and donating it back to our companies. So I think that I'd really like to sort of transition out of this model where the only way that we can do things and sort of create these advantages for ourselves is through barter, though I do think barter has a lot of other incredible opportunities. So.
I mean, a big problem with space, like your space issue, is people sit on their space to warehouse it. And so that's why a lot of the spaces are...
Although right now the New York Times just posted an article that these spaces are selling their window spaces as advertising. So if they're going to sell it to advertisers, there must be some term of a contract. And if we turned over our entire box office to them, that's... 10, 12 grand that we won't miss for the month because we won't be paying the 16 grand for the space rental. So it seems like there might be some opportunity of some creative...
But isn't that what Chishama used to do, right? Chishama.
Yeah. And it still does. And I think we just need it on a wider scale with local government support.
Yeah, but the spaces are dicey. Sorry to say.
Well, maybe because they don't have this... The people giving up the spaces don't have the correct advantages to do so. If it's just philanthropic, it's not going to work for them. But there are capital advantages to doing it, I think.
Clearly, you raised some
hackles or shekels, whatever they're called, with the death penalty thing. Once we get to the Q&A at the end, please remember we are, what is it, hackles?
Hackles
being raised, and we have a mic for you to come raise your hackles in public.
But I think, I just want to say, I think that that's like, I'm so glad you said it. It's such a hateful thing to talk about, but it's so fucking real. And it's huge. It's at the center of so much of this discussion in this country is this issue of value of art, you know, and it cuts across an education question, money questions, like just like the national character, like this historical model, what is the artist in this country, like the political history of the, you know, that, and definitely in the last 20 years, the decimation of like the value of that role, like the hateful use of the term liberal or elite, or, you know, these things are just, they're so powerful, and, you know, and we're ensconced in Dumbo in New York City. It's like, let's take 15 feet, you know, walk in a direction, and then you really, good luck, you know, and you're like, I'm a dance artist. It's like, you're a what? You know, it's like, you know, I'm just like, you know, I mean, and there's all sorts of pockets of great art and artists in this country, but I just think it's like that we, you know, that this can't be articulated on a sort of political national scale. I think that's like a huge, huge problem. And actually, I think that's why it's really critical that artists engage activism component in their work, right? That, like, it really is important, because then the people in your neighborhood who might not get what you're doing will get that you're helping them. And and if it's a part of your practice, then it's not this other thing that you have to do. It's this part of what's critical in getting up, that like, oh, I have to go to my studio, oh, I have to go engage with my neighborhood or engage with my local politic.
And I do just want to say, I think waking up every day and choosing to make art is a radical activity, and one that it is certainly deserving and has social merit, but I think that, as you said, if you walk sort of 15 feet in any other direction, it can be very, very humbling.
The slippery slope, though, for me in terms of the funder model is, you know, for the past, I don't know how many years, we've had to equate, you know, here's my dance piece that will also solve AIDS and teach literacy and teach self-esteem, and I will do an arts education program, and I will, and like, where's the dance, or where's the play? Like, suddenly you are solving crises that are global and that are systemic and that you have no actual talent or real business to try and solve, some of us. Some of us, that's what you're geared towards. But, you know, Aaron has brought up numerous times, like, artistic quality versus community engagement. And so there's so little funding to actually just make your work, you know, to research and lie on the floor and write your words and do all that navel gazing. But you've got to do all this other stuff on top of it.
Can I say something, being the older person? Actually, this is pretty recent. I mean, that only happened in about the 80s or the 90s. With the Republicans and the so-called culture wars. I really don't think artists were looked down upon and, you know, slandered 2 decades ago like they might be now. And I feel like we can turn that around. We really can. That is not entrenched in this country, really. I mean, I think we have a great heritage. I mean, look at you know, watch television for a day, and most of the shows have something to do with artists and arts. They really do. I mean, it doesn't have to be that way. What?
What channel do you watch?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, am I being just stupid to say that? I don't know. But or watch popular TV. I mean, I swear to God, I didn't see the Wooster Group, but I read about it on Claudia's blog. Recently, and then I saw, I didn't actually see the CSI episode, but I saw a little glimpse of it, and I go, they're doing the Wooster Group. They stole it. And then I saw something else where somebody had stolen something, a headpiece that I had made for my last show, and I saw it on TV. So it's like mainstream TV is just stealing stuff from us right and left. Which means that it's valuable. Somebody wants it, you know, and it's like...
But I think it's interesting what you're talking about, because I think it gets at so many different conversations. I think there is maybe perhaps, I don't know, please correct me if you think I'm wrong, do you think there was maybe a longer lag time between, like, the avant-garde and the appropriation of the avant-garde? And I think that that lag time has gotten a lot shorter, you know?
Short.
And I think that technology is a big part of that. I think the fact that, like, there are diversified I can think of people who I went to college with who were really fucking smart, who like took all those fancy semiotics courses, moved and went straight up to Hollywood to make like big fucking dumbass movies, you know? And they were the ones that were like Lacan, you know? And it's like, you know, and but that like they did, there is, I do think there is like fluidity and movement between the popular art. I mean, what Ben said I think is really interesting, that like, you know, we are, I don't want to speak for other people, but like I know this happens to me where I get very like, I'm in the weirdo group, and like the weirdo group has nothing to do with, you know, the other group, and yeah, you know, and then like you see like some, you know, you, there are instances of curiosity and beauty in popular forms. I mean, I, you know, listen to all kinds of music, for example, but it's like, so I think it's it, then it becomes really tricky and challenging to know like, well, what is the progressive art like, and who is making the progressive work, and what does that even mean, you know, like and who owns that title, and you know, if there's people who are like you know, it has to do with sort of like where you place cultural value in a culture. Like if you're placing cultural value on immediacy, then like whoever the fuck is making webisodes on YouTube is the best artist, you know? Like, but if you're placing cultural value on like really obscure marriage between theater and opera, then you're like, wow, Worcester Group, you know? You know, it's and again, it's, for me, it gets back to this thing that you said about like. And I appreciate what Aaron said about the difficulty in, of the country being so big, but I also think it's really frustrating on some level that we don't have a sense of a national arts profile or an identity, a stand. I hate though. I can't believe I say this. But I think we're getting further and further away. You know, it's not like there's 60 bands with 1 million fans. There's 1 million bands with 60 fans now. Yeah. And I think the you know the.
Ouch.
But that's like an awesome thing. That's fantastic. That's localism, right? And I think that I think the performing arts world really needs to sort of deal with that and address that. And I think that there's a lot of power in that. But because we're so resistant, we're like waiting for like who's the next blah blah blah. You know?
Yeah. I just think you need to sort of abandon traditional models of success and say, all right, well, I'm one of 1 million bands and I have these 3 fans and they're my community and how do I build and engage with them?
Yeah.
I think it has to do with that form, though.
I have way more fun at like a show with 60 people than I do with 1 million. Like, you know, it's exciting. Like, this is not a bad thing. I agree with you, but I also think each form has its own contingencies. I'm sorry. Like, I can't ask a group of 9 dancers to get in a fucking van and drive for 12 hours and say, dance! You know, like, it's like, you know, and just... Maybe you don't have to, but, like, no one is, so what if that's happening?
No, they're
like,
no,
you know,
okay.
Eagle Ager's doing it, and MGM Grand, they're creating different models of touring. I mean, there are dance people that are pursuing the dance band thing, but I'm just saying, like, just to say, like, there is also, you know, it's like, I have people who work with me who have children. It's like, you know, it's like these, you know, there are also other issues. It's like we can't all stay 22 forever, you know? And I mean, I'm not, you know, I just want to put it out there, you know? It's like the things that you want when you're a certain age are different at a different age and you have different realities. But I think, honestly, I think we're getting to this, I mean, I think this is a bigger part of the economy issue, but right. Smackdown.
I'm actually going to totally.
Let's go.
Someone's got. I really wanted someone to throw water on someone else.
Yeah.
I'm not going to resist that.
Yeah,
but.
I appreciate the resistance. I do. I'm totally pro SmackDown. But Miguel, you're not 22 and you just hurt yourself.
Yeah.
I could hear that. Because I know it's your birthday tomorrow.
Don't fuck with me, Miguel.
I'm going to move us on to Rachel Chavkin of The Team.
No, I'm just like nervous that I am not supposed to be up here because I feel like I have at this point just much more questions than answers. And like actually, the team is doing is fairly happy, I don't know. I don't feel like there's a lot of people who are doing what they love in the world, and. I'm just very conscious of that as I think about how we justify our existence and how we should, I believe we should get
paid for our work. I think we should also, I'm really struck by the artist as citizen. Sorry, this is rambling. Healthcare for your knee was what I wrote down as the thing that is the major problem in my company's life. It has meant performers having to drop out of shows to take either equity gigs or different paying gigs to get healthcare. So that's for us. We are paying what for us right now is a living wage that I don't know will be a living wage in probably another year or two in our life, but for right now, don't work unless we are on a slow model in the sense that it takes us several years to make a work, and we don't work unless we can cover life, at least in the rehearsal room at this point. But it's the healthcare that has been the huge problem, and it has meant that for a work that we spend 2.5 years on, a performer can't be a part of the culminating act of that work. So that's our hugest problem, and I think the things that I guess fire me up that we've talked about are how the question of how to bring non-artists into our space, because I don't know how much value we have to. I think we have a lot of like wonderful intellectual value to each other, but in terms of other Americans or world citizens having any idea what we do, I know that one of the things that just I'm thinking about is how to continue expanding our audiences past the normal downtown group, which you were bringing up. And I think the other thing that I was thinking about is just wanting there to be more formal discourse, like about the work. That's just something that struck me, because like it's wonderful to get reviewed, however the review goes, I guess. But it's also so short after, again, 2.5 years of work. And so that's just something that I was thinking about, is like wanting an arena where there is, you know, profound. And I just was at the National Student Drama Festival in Britain, and there were 15 student shows there, and the 450 kids who are at this festival, and it's mostly university and some high school, then critiqued the shows the next day. And the first time I was going into this, I was like, oh, this is going to be a disaster. And it was kind of magnificent. And they gave negative criticism, they gave positive criticism. But I just was like, that's so deeply rewarding. And I just, that's something that I'm thinking about. I don't know what that has to do with the economy, though.
Well, it means a lot, as all these newspapers and magazines are folding, that we lose the opportunity for more coverage, and the word counts shrink, and so the level of discourse shrinks. And if it goes online, and yes, we have the democratic blogosphere, and that's great, but then you no longer get the benefits that the sort of gatekeeping of the original outlets had provided.
Blog thing is also, isn't there like a whole, I've read this critique of the blog thing of like, you only go to the blog if you're interested in the blog, like, you know, whereas in the newspaper you'd be like, oh look, there's a movie, oh wow, what's that, you know, like, I mean, you know, the internet is great, but we like tend to go to where we know also.
Which is why it becomes very important for you to make sure that your work isn't being critiqued only on theater or dance blogs, but how is it speaking to population as a whole. I'm not saying drive the work for that, but certainly if the topic that you are interested in pursuing in your art does have sort of larger societal ramifications, then can you get those bloggers to deal with your work critically? And then maybe it provides new audiences for you, but at least a new perspective for you to see your own work.
I was at a Kennedy Center marketing seminar this morning that the field gets some money from the Carnegie Corporation. And so they're doing this exit strategy, which is they're going to stop giving us money and they're going to make us go or encourage us to go to consultations and seminars. And there's a lot of goodness in that. And Michael Kaiser, who runs the Kennedy Center, is quite astute in many, many ways. But this marketing thing was so weird because they're telling us that they have a $100 million budget. and 50 million of that comes from earned revenue, and they're telling us how to use Facebook and Twitter, and it just sort of stunned me. And then they're talking about how to market the musical Ragtime, and they're talking to, you know, this is a group of 30 of us who are all, you know, the field is one of the only service organizations there, the rest are theater companies, you know, totally small emerging and mid-sized, and they're talking about having a $50 million budget and how to capture Twitter users, and just the irony just like killed me. You know, how do we, it's not about competing, but how do we even play in that field? I mean, it's the democratization of all of this stuff, of the marketing efforts and the audience of it, is just, I don't know, it just really struck me as ironic. $50 million.
They can pay people just to Twitter.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, exactly, and someone said that to me the other day,
it's
that's
the answer
a new
to
thing.
Everything.
Yeah.
Twitter.
Twitter about it, like, again, but who cares? Like, who's following it? Like, who's, is anyone reading it? I don't know, but that's maybe a question for John, but I'm going to push this on to Miguel, because it's late.
Oh, I don't know that I have so much to add. I mean.
I doubt that.
Girl. I feel like I'm like the little dwarf in that opening video, the one that came out from under the, I like him. Well, you know, I mean, when I read the topic and thing about it, I was thinking, God, like, what's different now? And I was like, I was broke before, and I'm broke now. You know, like, I mean, you can't miss what you never had. You know, and I mean, and I think in dance, it's, I say that, and I don't mean to be glib, but I do have a lot of friends who don't work in dance, who have professional jobs, and they're, like, really super stressed out, and I hear, like, the thing, and my mortgage, and my this, and da-da, and I'm kind of like, don't have a mortgage, never had it. Never have had just one job my entire adult life. I've only ever understood patchwork income. I have never had health insurance my entire adult life. I'm sorry, that's true. The only people I know who own houses, it's because their parents helped them. So it's on the one hand, I will say I am fortunate. I'm not a Pilates instructor or yoga teacher. I know that I'm sure a lot of those people, or massage therapists, or people who work in that field are taking a hit because those people, their clients are not. But I don't know, you know, I feel lucky, I guess, you know, that I've always been paranoid enough to have like four jobs at the same time, or my income coming from all these different sources, because I have work, and I just figured that that's just kind of, I've always just thought that that's how it worked. Like, that coupled with like a willful denial of the ridiculous state of my financial affairs, you know, like, you know, like, I mean, well, I have, which I have finessed, and I could teach, I'm prepared to teach the workshop at the field. You can sign up any day. I mean, you know, when I think about it, it's like, I have debt, I have a career, you know, it's like, I don't need to go there, but let's just say that I walk through life relatively blissfully ignorant, because I'm like, oh yeah, I owe all that money, anyway, you know, which is not good. I'm not saying it's healthy, but neither is an office job for me, you know, or worrying about money all the time. So, I don't know, you know, and it's like, I think it's a challenging time, you know, and I love playing devil's advocate, even though I tend to believe often the things that I'm railing against, that, you know, it's just the nature of my personality, but, you know, I do think often about this, like, thing of, like, the artist now has to be the entrepreneur. I mean, even just this title of this, like, the entrepreneur, it's like, oh, you know, like, we're on the front of the train, you know, and I chose dance because it's weird, it's like, you know, the sort of the gimpy cousin of the arts, you know, and I mean, I've always loved that about dance, you know, I really do. I generally think that there's a lot of power on the periphery. I've never understood, you know, periphery is the center to me, like, just always has been, you know, but I also think about all the artists that, like, will never be the business minded person who are great artists. And I could think of, I don't want to name names, but I could think of people that I know even from New York, like from the 80s, or, you know, like, you know, people who fell by the wayside, you know, inside of all that. And I think it's, so, you know, I think it's great that we have all this idea of like merging the language of business and art, but I also wish that we would maintain a sophistication about the language of art, you know, and an ability to see well, perceive sophisticatedly. Like, and I would challenge, you know, by the same token, the flip side of the coin, maybe this isn't a popular statement, you know, certainly in dance, I can also say, you know, a lot of dance is really freaking boring and super uninteresting, super unchallenging, super like I'm going to make the same fucking dance I made last year with the same terrible costumes, you know. Like, sometimes I look at dance in New York and I'm like, or I get the flyers and I'm like, did this person like, have they like walked down the street lately? Like, have they walked into a gallery in the last 15 years? Like, have they like, you know, I mean, I'm just saying, you know, it's just real. I mean, I know that that's, I feel like I can say it because I come from the form, you know, but, you know, I mentor these kids through the Theater Development Fund. There's this amazing program called Open Doors, and I take these kids and we take them to dance performances and we talk to them about it. And they're all kids from public high schools in New York. Most of them are students of color. Almost actually all of them are. You know, and you go to these dance shows and you're like, wow, a lot of white people, a lot of like, I mean, and I'm pro navel gazing kind of to a point, you know, but then you're sitting there with this kid and this kid's like, I don't understand, and I'm trying to be like, you know, do backbends conceptually, like, well, R doesn't have to mean, you know, and then I'm kind of also like, yeah, you're right, it's meaningless and bad, you know, like, you know what I mean, like, at a certain point, it's really intense, if you sit next, you sit with, like, a, you know, a kid from a public high school and see a show, and suddenly you're seeing it through their eyes, and you're like, well, how does this speak to them, and why should it, you know, and so where is, it's so complicated, right? Because by the same token, I totally believe that like the artist should just get as strange as possible, you know. And so you know, it's a double truth moment. By the same token, I'm sort of fascinated, shocked, sometimes dismayed, sometimes just fascinated by how many of my peers and younger people are so illiterate in relationship to funding and these models that we're even talking about. You know, I know people who, like, for years are like, oh, maybe I should start applying for grants. And I'm like, yeah, you should do that. You know, because, and it's part, and a lot of times those are women. I think it's really, I think there's a gender discrepancy. I think women are that don't see themselves as valuable and therefore don't want to apply for things. That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying, I've just noticed that within the community. I've noticed that there's a general sense. I mean, I know a lot of, great female artists who I know who, like, I've never written a grant, I've never, so I'm just going to put it out there. I think it's a tricky topic, you know, but it came up last summer with a bunch of artist friends of mine who are women who are like, we were talking about, like, why does this happen, you know? And around issues of entitlement and who feels like they can talk about their work and who feels like they can't and with what level of authority, you know? So, yeah, I am going to go there. Sorry. Okay, go. That's great. No. You feel that way. They don't feel like they can ask for it. I feel like
one
that's
one of the issues is that women won't work for other women. Do you actually write your grants, or does a woman write your grants?
I write my grants. I write my grants in collaboration with my manager.
Yeah. Who's a female, right?
No, it's a man.
Oh,
now.
Okay.
It's been women in the past. Sorry, I didn't mean to unlock a thing, but I just think it gets back to this question of value and the sense of worth and econ, you know. I guess for me, it gets into this question of, like, in dance at least, something that my friend Juliette Mapp brought up to me last year. She was like, how we as dance people embody this poverty, like, literally. Like, we embody it imaginatively, we embody it corporeally, we embody it in the sense, like, we can't take up space. We embody it, like, we make these pieces in these small little rooms for these small little things with small little ideas, you know? Like, we're not allowed to think voluminously. And how this economic reality, and which has been reality as far as I've known in New York forever, how that has, like, literally neuromuscularly repatterned us to think in this one way.
Can I jump on?
Yeah.
That's something that I've taken very much from ERS, actually, is in talking with John Collins, director of the company, about how the touring life of that company was rejuvenated by GATS, which was 13 actors strong and massive, and now Sound and the Fury, I think 12 performers, massive. And this ties to the grant process, I guess, and I actually personally find grant writing to be exceedingly helpful in the sense that very early on in the process, I am accountable to the page in terms of articulating
the project in a way that hopefully is passionate and gets other people passionate about it. And it's a chance to talk about my work. And actually, I'm learning right now that it's a, I mean, this is a process that I've been getting over for the past year as the team has gotten larger of, like, you do call the grant maker and you speak to them. And I know this is something the field told me 3 years ago, I think, when I first took my grant writing course there, but that it's about a personal relationship and getting people excited, and that actually thinking larger, that thinking smaller is almost antithetical in a way to making people, I think, excited about the idea. And I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, for me, big doesn't mean like I have to make a piece with a big. It's like it has nothing. It has to do with imagination. It has to do with scope of imagination, yeah. which can mean, you know, I'm also with Roseanne. I'm on the like, leave us alone, give us the money. You know, like a little bit like, I mean, I feel like to presume that there's going to be somehow one grant that like each grant, because unfortunately, a grant is also a value system. And it is also a timeline, and it is also a thing. So it's like, not everyone fits to that, you know, unfortunately. And so that also creates a certain kind of weaning. I don't think one thing can be the answer to everything. But you know, I think there are people who make pieces in a month. I think there's people who make pieces in 3 years. I think there's people who like, I don't know. There's just so many different ways, you know. And I don't. I appreciate the like everybody should do this now thing. But it's also like. I don't know, that's tricky, but that's a whole other thing. I just want to say a couple more things. Just
Miguel?
Can I say one last thing?
I love you.
Okay, that's fine. I told you I talked too much.
Thank you. We got to move to Q&A because it's 10 o'clock.
Yes.
So can we have a little more, is it possible a little more lights in the house? I know there are some rabble-rousers in the audience who have things to say. I'm going to encourage you or actually demand that you come forward to the microphone. And I will... really politely ask you to be kind and respectful and smack it down in a respectful way, if that's possible. Welcome to the mic.
It's interesting to me that when we talk about money, we go to the rational and all of the compulsion about money. And I'm surprised myself. I'm feeling a very emotional reaction to the discussion. There are lots of support I want as an artist. I want people to look at my work critically. I want some of the glow. I want the detailed critique. I want people to help me editing my photographs because I'm a dance photographer. And I want the financial support. And I want an integrity of those relationships. And I'm stuck in this old model of the patron, where the people who feel they're getting value by experiencing my work are going to come forward and support me. That's utterly ridiculous. Those people usually don't have the money to support me. They can't. It hasn't happened for a long time. But some romantic part of me is attached to that. And I also have a dream that I'm going to go to sleep and some foundation is going to put money under my pillow. And I'll wake up and I won't even have to bother writing the grants, although I'm a decent writer. So we have this new notion that our source of support is totally outside of our community of relationships of integrity. And I wonder if that idea has traction or reality to you, and if it does, how do you deal with that emotional disparity that I'm trying to talk about?
Wow, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Question for you, Jeff, right?
Yeah, I mean, that idea is what started us. We absolutely exist within our own, what is it, community of integrity or relationships of integrity. I'm really into that. It's like a new, and I think there needs to be a major reality check about what expenses should be. You know, I appreciate how much everything costs. I understand that. But maybe things need to start getting made, I think we do need to start making more with less and aggressively, I'm sorry, less with more, aggressively, no, sorry, time out. We need to start making less with less. Like, we have access to less and you make less, but it's better.
the struggle that we have in my company is that since we are not being presented by a presenting organization, that means that we, in the very least, just to share the work that, whether we spend 6 months, a year, or 10 years creating it, just to share that work is going to cost us many, many, many thousands of dollars that need to be raised. That's not including what we put in that space and the cost of paying artists for their time. And so I really do appreciate the idea of less with less, but working on a small scale really doesn't work for a theater collaborative like mine because the bar of the money that we need to raise is just so high.
I'm just going to say, I think in terms of the integrity of the gentleman who spoke, that part of it for me is about the personal evaluation of what it means for you to be successful and what are all those different sectors and how can you give them their weight and value for you rather than going by the traditional model of a grant or whatever those things are. But, like, what does it mean for you to be successful? So I'm so delighted by that idea of the integrity of all those different pieces. There's also a mic upstairs for those folks in the balcony.
Can I say something about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think I'm not sure if I fully actually understand the question, but I also will say I think something that was really powerful for me a couple years ago was when I stopped demonizing people in authority, like people like presenters and people who work at funding organizations. I'm trying not to use the word funders more. I think there was also, for a long time, I held on to the shield of like I am the artist and it's all them. You know, like I'm holding on to this beautiful precious jewel and they just want to take it away from me. You know, and when you start to realize that, like, most of the people, I mean, I've encountered, maybe I've just been lucky, but a lot of the people I've encountered, they want to help. Like, you know, you don't end up working at an arts agency because you're an asshole. I think, you know, you have to make hard choices, unfortunately, and there's, like, not enough money to go around. So I think it's also a perceptual shift that sometimes is important to realize, like, you're not, like, you learn how to ask without expecting, and you kind of keep going. I mean, it's just, that's kind of just part of being an adult.
Great. I see a gentleman who wants to come forward. Uh-oh.
Two and a half hours of listening to all of us talk about our financial duress and our how dark the skies are. We as artists in all of our fields in this country, specifically this country, are not the poorest people. We are the richest people. We have more in our souls and in our creativity than the other 95% of the population. And all I've heard people talk about was the money, the grants, and no one is addressing the real consequences of the financial situation. I have 7 friends. 2 are sleeping in their cars. One of them borrows $10 a week from me so he can buy pasta and butter to eat, and he's sleeping under a bridge. And these are people who have been famous. These are people who have had major successes in their careers. But no one here has talked about the paucity of spirit among the artists. We're not even discussing our spirit. We're talking about money. Our wealth is our spirit and our inner strength, and no one is addressing that.
I had the David, I'm glad you came forward. I actually encouraged David to come forward because he approached me at the intermission to basically discuss that matter, and I encouraged him to come forward because this is a smackdown, and it's about getting issues on the table and different. We all have different ideas and thoughts and feelings about a lot of these things, and I'm at a loss for words a little bit. I appreciate your thoughts, and I wonder if anyone else on the panel or in the audience, Aaron, you know, or anyone else wants to respond to that.
You don't keep going if you don't have the spirit to do it. I mean, yeah.
It's That's why we're all working six jobs in order to.
Did someone in the back want to come forward? Yeah, use the mic if you can. Please come forward.
Actual life force. It's what makes us who we are. It just makes us that weird group of people that you talk about. It's that difference that we are. It's that sound that we hear that others don't hear. It's the words that we write that others cannot write. It's the movement that we make with our bodies that the others don't know.
When you look at us, do you feel like we don't have spirit?
You do, but somehow you're not communicating that through this process of the panel.
I think we take it as a given.
I think Miguel did.
Just,
I mean, and I don't really mean to separate him, but I think he has come across as more of the artist. He's still there. He's still digging. He's still feeling it. He's still hungry for it. I know you have been here. I'm a New Yorker. I've been here all my life. So I don't know it from the 80s. I know it's from when I've been born. Okay? And I've seen the changes. But there's something that we need as artists. Yes, we need to be more activism. There needs to be more activism. But how do we do that without losing the sense of creativity? And no, we can't go to this and that and that and this and be part of that and that, because then you don't have time to create. You don't have time to look at your navel, which you need. You need that time.
But if there's no money, you don't have the time.
I don't need money to create.
How do you pay your rent?
I pay my rent by having a 9-to-5 job.
Okay, so instead of having the 9-to-5 job, I think what we're saying is we don't want to be working outside of our industries. Ideally, we'd like to be paid for our work.
And I would love to do that, but then that includes activism. So how do we get together collectively and be politically potent? Not just come together, but be potent where we create change.
What do you practically suggest we do?
I suggest that we do come together, create a movement. We have to be a movement. We have to be a movement. We have to be a movement. We have to make them understand that we create change, not only in this country, but in the world.
Great.
We have to let them know that without a creative force, there is no life. There is no liars.
Thank you. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you know, I guess something that I would like to hear from, I think I've been on a couple things and of these panels and been to, and attended them, and I think you could end up walking away feeling like a lot of people said a lot of stuff, and then they don't really have like this sort of like, and then I'm going to go do that. If people have things to go do, I'd love to hear that, or if people on this panel or people on the first panel have a, and now you can go do blah. Possibly this gentleman.
Khalil has an answer, I think.
Hey, Khalil. So I'm a native New Yorker. I'm from Queens. My name is Khalil. I'm Mustafa. I'm very happy to be here. This has been fed me in a lot of ways. And you know, I really do feel. I do feel that artists are kind of. I have a special place, you know. And I definitely heard that. I do. Like a place as far as a responsibility, because as far as class goes, we're not in a class that's on an economic scale. You know what I mean? We're in a different class, like an X class. So we have a different relationship to everything. But practically, tomorrow. I had a contract, right? And they offer me a certain amount of money. And I've been so tormented over this. Because I don't think I've been able to really say how much it really costs. You know? And I've been thinking about me accepting the amount of money they're offering is not only hurting me, it's distorting their idea of how much what they're asking me to do actually costs. Yes. So I've been wrestling with this, and I'm saying, so not only am I selling out myself, and of course my wife, that I am selling out all the other artists who might be doing this in some future sense. So tomorrow I'm going to make a phone call, as hard as it is, because money, I really don't believe in it. But tomorrow I'm going to make that phone call, and I'm going to really just say, have an honest conversation and say, you know what? That's not how much this costs, you know? And this is how much the real cost is. So I'm going to do that tomorrow.
Thanks, Khalil.
One of your panelists said that the habits of the market economy are in our bones, and I've really seen that working out in my commandeering this project called The Invention Company. I guess I just wanted to put out there that I believe so strongly that barter is an underestimated force. And that when you get 15 talented people in a room from all walks of life, from all kinds of professions within the arts, who's to say that the choreographer right next to you can't provide something for you that person needs choreography and I can provide arranging piano, or that someone else can give a space in exchange for the cat sitting, or it goes on and on and on. You will never know until you ask the people in a room. Here's what I've learned in attempting to create a theater company that is fundamentally based on the barter and exchange of resource concept. All sorts of complaints, problems, theories will come up. Those people who seem to be so attached to the market economy that they can't think outside that box will get angry at me and leave the project. Those people who believe that exchanges can happen will stay with it and we will achieve great results. And so we're beginning to build a company that has those results. If there's any little revolution in the making, I would like to see that part of it. The funding issues are complex. They take a long time to work out. I haven't quite applied to the number of grants that I could, but that's not what I'm doing at this time in my life. I'm working on that other stuff.
But can I just say respectfully, barter. I mean, maybe I need a better definition of barter, but I have a sense that barter is the default economy in dance and has been for a really long time in relationship to just like, I give you my time because working for you is meaningful. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, you know, and I feel like that's I just want to put, you know, just to say that, like, I also think that there's an inherent notion that money is ugly. Or something in that, like I don't know. It's a problematic thing, and I think at least in dance, I'm just talking maybe really specifically right now about dance. You know, it's like I think it's really hard for people in dance, as you know, was discussed in the first panel, and Jen brought it up too. Like to be able to give themselves a value for what they need. I mean, I feel like those instances of exchange happen all the time. Like I see them happening. And they've happened. I wouldn't have stayed in New York if there wasn't that, because it's an extraordinarily beautiful community of people that work in that field. But I guess if we're just talking about like how does it's a question, like how does it work in relationship to like having a bunch of people that you want to work with, like over 6 months to make a project.
To me, barter is a small word, and exchange of resources on a big scale is what I'm aiming at. I'm not sure there is one word. Barter is just the little word to describe it. I appreciate the way that the dance community has historically done more perhaps than any other artistic community in that. But when you're creating a large-scale multimedia event or a musical theater or an opera or something like that, it's very challenging to say to a set designer, okay, you're talking to a choreographer, what can we do in exchange? It's little explored. And the weakest link in the chain is space. Why can't spaces say, we're going to give you this $200 per hour in exchange for your work, your show, your publicity, whatever it is that you can offer with these talented people in a room? That's the weak link. I'm saying there's so many productions that fall by the wayside because they can't come up with the space rental. I don't know where that leads, but that's what.
That's great. Thank you. Okay. We have time for one more very courageous soul to step forward and speak their mind. I've scared everyone. Really? No one? Upstairs? Anyone? Morgan. Come on.
Okay. All right. That Rachel brought up, right, which is this issue of discourse, which to me is not about the press and the critics and
right.
the blogs.
Right. Yeah.
That's so minimal compared to what I witnessed when I was doing research about moving to London for a job, which is artists, and I think some of it happened in the 80s when the cultural wars happened and when certain sort of aesthetic parents got really sick of having people writing books about them that spoke the truth about them. And when it became the, again, like I pressed this, I think it's one of my points, is like the ivory tower got to talk about. And I'm an academic who's writing about artists. So like when we got to talk about you and you stopped talking about you. And that's the thing that I think was really going on in your example of the college kids talking about the work that they were seeing. Yeah. The artists need to be talking about their work with each other. They learn from each other aesthetically, but they also can then bring the audiences with them. I mean, like, just to push Claudia's Performance Club, like a free advertisement for it, it's a phenomenal thing. Like, these audience members get together, they see a show, and they go out and they talk about it. What more could we ask for audience members, but also for artists? Like, talk to each other about resources, about art, about business models, about all this kind of stuff. I think that's what we really need, to some extent, in smaller focus groups kind of thing, as well as in these big panels.
But I want to put a plug in for the fact that a lot of those things already exist.
Of course.
Like, MoveIn Research, that's their freaking... Yeah. That's what they do. They put out a journal. They have critical correspondence. They like, I mean, there's so many people, artists, doing volunteer work in that organization to create these discourses. I think it's a partially. I think it's we have to be careful to always think that we have to reinvent the wheel. I'm not saying you're saying that,
but
just
yeah.
You know, it's also about access and about learning about the things that are there. I do think the weak link maybe is relating then that to a broader audience. That's what's challenging. That's really challenging.
Great. Because I'm a control freak, which I've said three times now, I want to, because I also know practicality and pragmatic things, and one of the things that I'm sort of inspired by tonight is that there are so many different answers, and they're all really have to be digested personally. So barter may be the answer for a lot of us, maybe valuing the dollar more in our life, like for Khalil saying no to this funder tomorrow, which I want to talk to you about and make sure that's the right thing. Before you do it. But his practical response is, I'm going to have an honest conversation with that funder tomorrow. And, you know, maybe Morgan's going to walk away from this and go, I want to do this. And so I'm going to, you know, not try to walk away with, like, this is what we're all going to do, and we're all going to... But, you know, if the woman in the back and the gentleman in the back, you know, are really serious about starting their movement, how do you do that? How do you sign up, you know? I appreciate that adding to my job description, but I'm actually going to say no to that because I'm getting better at saying no. But I'm going to encourage you as an artist, activist, New Yorker to start it and to get going on that yourself. Wow, that was very diplomatic of me. But I do want to thank all of these guys and all of you guys and ask you to continue the conversation whatever way, shape, and form you do in your life. Check out the P Club blog and add to that. We're going to, you know, post our audio cast, and the stuff will be in our blog as well. And I want to thank Robert for hosting us, and all of you guys for coming out. So thank you all very, very much.